Hello and welcome to episode 74, The Morality Question. We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. And I'm Tatiana, and I'm here with
Jessica
and May.
And you can contact us at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com or on Twitter at DCTVGumption. Email ladieswgumption@gmail.com, or you can find Ladies with Gumption on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and still Facebook. You can also Patreon us. You can patronize us on Patreon, which is www.patreon.com/DCTVGumption. And one day soon, we will do something with that. Anyway, first we've got news to discuss, which is that a fond farewell that we are giving Arrow, which is coming to an end next season. It's going to have a 10-episode final season with season 8. And Jessica would like to pitch...
Yeah, well, they should kill Oliver in season 7 finale instead of Crisis, because it makes more sense. I'm still, like, I know everyone's always just, like, default assuming that he's going to die next year in the finale, because, you know, that would be episode 8, and you have two episodes of, like, wrap-up or whatever. But I still think that we already know that Oliver's going to die, so there wouldn't be any kind of tension about who's going to die in Crisis. You know, there's no tension for Supergirl, there's no tension for The Flash, because if Oliver is still alive, then obviously they're going to survive. So the only thing that could be put that tension back into play is if they kill Oliver in season 7, and then Crisis is still coming, and that means that, like, the whole world is now, everybody's up in play. Which is what I think they should do. They probably won't do it, because it's the lamest, they're, you know... Greg Berlanti and all the showrunners usually choose, like, the lamest common denominator, but...
That is correct.
Yeah. Kill him in season 7, you cowards! Do it!
Well...
Alas.
I don't disagree with that, but I feel best, like, if they do kill him in season 7, then the tension just becomes, we know Barry's probably gonna die and then come back to life somehow.
Yeah, well, yeah, like, that's the whole thing, I think, like, mm-hmm. you know... If Oliver is still around, then obviously Barry's not going to die. So, like, why would I care about Crisis? There's no, like, any kind of drama they try to build up in season 6 of The Flash is just moot, because I already know that Oliver is already going to die for him in Crisis. Mm-hmm. But if Oliver is already dead, then Barry could still die in Crisis. So that way, like, The Flash keeps the thing they've been building on their series for since the pilot. And then and Supergirl would also have that as well, that tension there. And I still feel like you could do, because there's already Emiko, she's still around, and you could still do that aftermath of Arrow leading up into what happened in, like, the Crisis and all that kind of stuff. Because I don't think we're going to get to the whole point of what exactly happened that makes the Glades where it is when William and Mia are grown. So that could be part of. And just use Steven in flashbacks. Like, free Steven Amell. If he's only in flashbacks, he doesn't have to be in Vancouver all the time for the last 10 episodes when he already wanted to, like, be out by the end of the season. So, that's my pitch.
All right. That's the dream big.
That is a dream big.
In other news, the DC Not Extended Universe has replaced Will Smith in Suicide Squad. The Suicide Squad, which will be known to the rest of us as Suicide Squad 2, with Idris Elba in the role of Deadshot, which I think is the smartest move they could have made, because they're going to lose money without Will Smith, and I was like, unless they get Idris Elba, then they should just do a different character altogether, and here they are. Exactly. Here they are with Idris Elba instead. So wonderful for them. Finally, many of you may be wondering if we'll be discussing the elephant in the room. Do you want to take this, Jessica, or do you want me to do this?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, have we heard the rumor floating around? Yes. Will we discuss it? Not yet. Like, no, not right now, but at least not until it actually becomes official. And then, like, maybe for that podcast, we'll record having, like, a pizza party, you know, to talk about it. You know, does that sound sweet to y'all?
All right. So with that out of the way, we will now. It was very funny. Moving on into feedback. Okay, we've got an email from Shauna Shang, the only podcast that drives my lazy ass to wake up on Monday mornings for lesson. Aw, love that. So, Shang says that finally someone agrees on my view about La La Land. Yes, I can't believe more people don't. I remember watching with my ex, and I was just big question marks regarding the whole movie. The segment really opened my eyes to how many white savior movies and shows are out there. Disappointing, to say the least. And it's definitely an international problem, because the ads show how award-winning the films are, and we already have a problem with treating white people as superior in Asia.
That's exactly what's happening in Japan with this Green Book movie.
Yeah. And then we've got Supergirl thoughts, because, of course, I don't mind my husband finally killing Nazis. I can't believe David dyed his hair. It's purple like mine. Also, what kind of prison is it that they allowed Ben to have hair wax and Manchester to dye his hair? This is true. It's fantasy prison. National City has better rights for criminals than our world does, I guess. Anyway. So he loves the Superman villain gang. They're going to put the Colonel 6 feet lower. Anyway, aside from that, the elite literally burgled the British war, and somehow he's not supposed to stand. Please. I mean, it's very hard to imagine not standing. All right. It's wild that the writers want to spend time giving shit to the elite for wanting to beat up neo-Nazis, and, instead of the fact that the elite are a group of POC deemed wrong against a white hero, really, they really give the hottest takes. It feels like season 3 all over again, and it's so much worse because the subject the two groups disagree on are Nazis. But on the bright side, there is Lena and Alex team up. My agent core, Bro TP, is sailing, and I'm so stoked. Alex called Lena her friend. Sure, Jan, but I'll take it. I wonder if Alex is going to become the angel on Lena's shoulder. Ooh, I like that. Now that Lena would probably let her in on the experiments. I didn't expect this turn of events, to be honest. This is true. The question, do you think Alex would know Kara is Supergirl first, or Lena? I'm never imagining that Lena is going to find out about Kara. I've just decided that's not a thing.
I don't even think they made it a point to bother that they care.
Right, this season it doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. Just Lena even know Kara? I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, moving on to our Arrow correspondent, Tasha. This episode was pretty solid. I don't really have any complaints because it gave me all the things I've been wanting. Dyla and Elicity working together on a mission. Diaz dead. We finally meet Dante, and they worked on the relationship between Oliver and Emiko, William and Mia, and Dingle and Felicity. I like this thought. It says, Felicity has been feeling powerless for a while now. Things were just happening to her. I appreciate that her going on the mission this episode didn't turn into Oliver having to run in and save her because she's pregnant. I also appreciate that. She managed to stop Diaz without spiraling and losing herself. She took back some control. Also, Felicity sitting on the counter eating ice cream after a stressful day is a mood.
Great. All right.
So, Black Siren thinking non-deli meats and bananas would stop Mama Smoke's murder rage is kind of cute. I'm bitter that they don't give me Lila and Felicity interactions, but I like Laurel being a sounding board for Felicity. And I appreciate that Felicity kept in the loop on what's going on with Diaz, because that's how their relationship started. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting to see Oliver deal with the season 1 version of himself. I respect that it's her mission, but I also see his perspective. He's already done things the hard way, and he wants to spare her the prison sentence part of vigilantism. So, Adrian Paul, the Highlander, is Dante. While he's no Stan the Fan, he's a better villain than Diaz. He didn't feel like he was trying. He was just threatening. And the dive off the balcony while throwing knives was sweet. Also, she could watch Chyna White beating up Diaz and Baby Deathstroke all day long.
Lila Michaels. I keep calling
him Baby Slade. Baby Slade, yeah.
Yeah.
John Diggle, my greatest love, has returned to me. Delicity is back on track. But most importantly, they're done stuffing Dave and his glorious arms into that ugly-ass Argus uniform. There you go. Loving Mia Smoke the Intellectual, asking the real questions. Where is the body? And it was nice to see Mia and William bonding, even though it's sad they didn't get to grow up together. Side note, while I'm not shocked Dick knew about Mia, it's telling that Alyssi don't trust Dinah enough to inform her, especially since, unlike Roy, they were living in the same city. Hmm? Yeah, Connor's adopted. That's interesting and random. Diaz lit his childhood bully on fire, and then he died in the same manner.
Oh.
Arrow loves their parallels, and I love when they do them. That is a great parallel. I approve of it. All right. Lots of feelings. So her one big dislike is that I'm tired of Oliver letting people close only to have them betray him. Adrian Chase, Evelyn, Renee, and now Emiko. Predictions will go in the Arrow section, because why not? All right. So next up, we've got Shy One on The Flash. It's like almost everyone covered. We need a new EP for The Flash, or he needs help, and some of these writers need to step up in their game. Well, you know, just get right to it. The back half of the season has been too uneven for me not to notice. This episode was a prime example of that. Why were we getting that conversation between Barry, Sisko, and Caitlin about the cure in this episode when Barry announced in episode 12 that he wanted to use the cure against Cicada? What the hell did they think that Barry meant when he said that?
Right.
How did Sisko and Caitlin think Cicada was going to get the cure? That they were going to go to Cicada and ask him nicely? Why are we seeing them talk about this three episodes later? Episode 13 should have been when they addressed Barry's statement and had the discussion about choice versus force. Then there's a whole scene with Barry, Nora, and Sisko versus King Shark. Was Sisko going to die if Barry hadn't injected him? The whole argument they had in the storyline didn't make sense. What did Sisko mean they could have reasoned with him? He was willing to bet his life on them possibly being able to reason with him? Dude was seconds away from being shark bait, and he gets mad at Barry for making a split-second decision to save his life. It reminded me of that stupid scene in episode 6 when Caitlin yelled at Sisko for trying to warn her about her father. Nonsense. Anyway. She's very interested in seeing how they plan on pulling off giving Cicada the cure without forcing him. That will be very interesting. I was happy to see Joe back. We got some great and much-needed Iris and Joe moments. I love seeing Iris own that punching bag and seeing her talk about the effect Cicada had on her after the events of the last two episodes. Giving the middle finger to fanboys out there and their ignorant Mary Sue comments. Sherlock annoyed me this episode. Mm-hmm. I didn't enjoy his scenes or interactions with Dr. Lambden. It felt weird and they didn't make sense. He all of a sudden is a relationship guru, along with his eyebrow-raising scientific and Speed Force knowledge. I think the writers forgot he's Sherlock the detective and not Harry the scientist when they write his scenes.
Yeah.
Sorry, ladies. I'm sure you will be getting West Allen fans jumping off a ledge after this episode. Not only did Barry and Iris not kiss, they didn't share any scenes together. I was fine with it, because if they shared scenes, what would she have been doing? Sitting in Star Labs, listening to all that science and tech mumbo-jumbo that they were spouting off? I'm good. Instead, she had her own storyline with Joe. We wanted to see Iris separate herself from Star Labs, and she did this episode. Besides, it was about King Shark and Grodd, so I was not expecting too much in the West Allen department. I will say that as glad as I am that Joe is back, and I'm sure they needed to give him scenes where he was doing something relevant, it does give the impression that Iris is not talking to Barry about things. Yes, yes, it does. It does give that impression. It's OC for Barry not to be aware of what's going on with Iris in regards to her fears about returning to her office. I was happy to get the boxing scene, which we wouldn't have got if she was talking to Barry. So there's that. Next week, they'll have scenes together, and I have no idea what they'll be about, but I pray to the Flash gods that they write a kissing scene, because I believe a riot will happen if the writers don't stop tripping. She did enjoy the short-lived battle between King Shark and Grodd. I knew they weren't going to be able to go crazy due to their limited budget, so I wasn't expecting movie-quality effects or a long, drawn-out battle, but it was good. Enjoyed the father-daughter lightning throw team-up. Enjoyed that Barry was back to being more of the lead this episode. didn't even notice Ralph was missing until the end. I was going to say, I thought they just had him, like, walk by, right? Wasn't he, like, in the background somewhere?
I did not even... I noticed it was gone, because I, when Drolleg was being... I was like, why couldn't Ralph have done this? But
oh, I never seen him at all. Oh, okay. Maybe I imagined him. Anyway, she did not mind that he wasn't there. Didn't notice. I love the look of Iris's office. I wish we had a better look at it. We've only seen it at night recently. She did have a pic of her bae in her phone case, so that was a nice thing to take note of. That was the West Allen for the episode. Caitlin was okay this episode. She was part of explaining the mumbo-jumbo, so she did her thing. Sisko used his powers, and we can just assume he's still seeing Camilla because we don't know what is his life anymore. So yeah, overall the episode was okay, but now she's ready to get back to the main storylines, and so are we. Then we have an email from Mara. hello, Mara. I hope y'all had a great week. Last time I sent feedback was for your Love Boat episode over the winter hiatus. Oh, wow. So that's come back to us after a long time. I'm hoping to send feedback more regularly after today. Oh, yay. Love that. Okay. So the promo of 5 for 516 was the best part of The Shape Meets Water. Of The Shape of Water meets Dubious Scientific Ethics meets King Shark episode. It's probably a good title for it. What worked was Iris and Joe. Glad the show dealt with Iris' PTSD about Cicada in a nuanced manner, even though it deserved more screen time. It's important that the show highlighted that despite the fact that Iris and Joe are fearless and heroic, the amount of attacks on them takes a toll. I loved how Joe helped Iris through it. I think it's one of the few times that Joe was really helping Iris work through her emotions. It segues nicely into next week's episode, where Iris and Joe are beside Barry, armed with guns, anticipating whoever it is that has attacked Star Labs again. Also, it's great to see Joe back, and I missed him dearly. The only qualm about this plot was that it was utterly unconnected to the A plot, and it felt like laziness in terms of writing, because the writers didn't even bother trying to create a thematic link between the two plots. Yes, thank you. Anyway... So, moving on. I know Eric indicated that Iris is his favorite character to write for, and I think he and Lauren giving her a plot to explore her fears in some of the season's meatiest emotional scenes with her father indicate that, at least in relation to Iris, Eric makes an effort. That's nice. Now to the main attraction. Gorilla Grodd versus King Shark. Argus needs to be thrown away. They can't keep anything intact in that facility. Sorry, Lila. Sorry, Diggle. I love you both, but Argus is a disaster. And why the government has not conducted a full investigation into its own agency is beyond me. Didn't care about the Shape of Water-esque romance, but it wasn't the worst part. Sherlock consistently having scenes shoehorned in to provide romantic advice was beyond irritating, however. The big issue with this episode was how the ethics were handled. Garbage. I don't understand why writers, who never addressed how problematic it was to have one of its so-called heroes aid and abet a human trafficking ring, thought that they could handle the ethical considerations of administering a human cure. True. Caitlin and Sisko lost all credibility when they agreed to administer the cure on Cicada without his consent, thereby going against their rule not to use a cure on anyone without consent. There you go. Yes, so... Everyone was hypocritical, and they're totally okay with placing Grodd under a medically induced coma without his consent. So why do they care about Well, then. Okay. So, whatever. I like the father-daughter lightning throw. That was cool, I guess. That was good. Glad that there was something in there.
That was cool, visually.
Yeah. Yeah, let's hope Zach's sense brings a little more light into the show. The promo and the images look promising. I appreciate the promo featuring the West Allen family characters, with the exception of Eobard and Sherlock, because, of course, Sherlock has to be forced into everything. All right. So, yeah. Overall, irritated with how badly the writers screwed up what could have been a cool episode. But looking forward and hopeful to the future. I think that we are also feeling frustrated but hopeful, maybe. I don't know. All right. We've got a first-timer, Paulina. Hi. Welcome to our humble podcast. Longtime listener here. I've been following your podcast for over a year and recently left a review on iTunes.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
go back to read it later.
I thought I'd start sending some weekly feedback concerning my thoughts on DC TV. Thank you for this wonderful podcast. So many of us appreciate getting to hear you articulate your insights and thoughts. Oh, thank you. All right. So only watches the Flash and Black Lightning. So now we'll get some Black Lightning thoughts.
Yes.
Woo-hoo. I enjoyed Black Lightning this week. The episode wasn't quite at the levels of last episode, but it was still solid. It's definitely seen a resurgence in strength ever since Khalil died. Farewell, mm-hmm. Khalil. Because all four members of the Pierce family get to balance storylines. The episode did a good job portraying different threads. Jefferson being confronted by Lala. And Nissa stressing over Grace. And then Grace being able to shapeshift. A revelation. Does Grace know Nissa's thunder now? She must, right? Mm-hmm. Lynn clashing with Odell. And Jennifer getting excited about her suit, but facing a snag when things don't go according to Gambi's plan. I thought too much time was spent with Lala grappling with ghosts, but I did think the episode set up a lot of interesting things for the rest of the season. I also love how the family comes together at the end of the day, as BL's greatest strength is the Pierce family and showcasing them together. Agreed. Now the Flash. Not much to say about this episode. It was nice to see Lila. I enjoyed her quip about her daughter being turned into a son. After Nora's comments about how weird it must be to see a grown kid in the present, or Barry's grown kid in the present, one has to wonder why a show which has never considered the unethical implications of anything Team Flash has done is suddenly concerned now. Yes, we are all wondering this. They finally realized that ethics are a thing. Cherry-picking which ethical conversations to have is wrong, especially with regards to scientific or technological amelioration. And the writers are very much showing how ill-equipped they are to handle larger ethical questions about medicine and consent. I did thoroughly enjoy Iris's arc, as I always like when the show explores her feelings. It was great to see Jo help Iris work through her PTSD, which resulted from her run-in with Cicada. So, Candace has amazing boxing form. Yay! I think everyone agreed on that after this
and
week.
And she actually does at least use for a while.
Yeah. Her arc was the only emotional satisfying storyline, and I wish it had gotten more screen time. For now, I'm cautiously optimistic about Zack Stan's Flash episode next week. All right. Finally, we've got our last Flash feedback from Rachel. Rachel's getting tired of the sloppy writing for the Flash. I was really looking forward to this episode, but as it played, I was bothered by the fact that Nora didn't ask what the hell is going on. In the first episode of season 5, she talks excitedly about King Shark fighting Grodd before the team tells her. Spoiler alert. The writers forgot all about it. The show's written so sloppily that the writers forget stuff week to week. She's saying that Nora didn't bring up the King Shark versus Grodd battle that she was waiting for in episode 1.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, she could be like, maybe it's Grodd.
Oh, yeah.
So yes, that is true.
The museum has
failed
her.
Which is funny. It's ironic because she was talking about the museum this episode. And the ways in which the museum was wrong. So she could have been like, oh, the museum actually got something right. But anyway. Another example is what the heck happened to Caitlin's dad? Wasn't Spin supposed to come back? Besides trying to throw us off Mystery Girl trail in season 4, what was the point of Cecile being pregnant? Shouldn't Wally be coming back for 2 more episodes? Can we expand on Nora being queer? Why didn't they talk about a Young Rogues forming? The show is all over the place. I apologize for not greeting everyone properly at the beginning of the message. I could do it now, but I don't feel like using the mouse to go up and click. So, hello, ladies, is just going to go here. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Thank you for sharing your concerns with us. I think we share many of them. All right. With all that being said, we are now going to get into all of the Arrowverse shows, which are back from hiatus this week. We've got Supergirl and Arrow on side A, Flash, Black Lightning, and Doom Patrol on side B. And May, our hostess with the mostest, is going to take us through our likes, dislikes, and ladies with gumption of the week.
Yes, I will. Starting with side A, don't hassle me, I'm local / good faith. So side A will be kicked off with Supergirl. To recap, she faces off against the elite. Manchester Black breaks out of prison with the help of his new team, who are set on punishing the anti-alien forces. Supergirl pulls double duty as she tries to apprehend Manchester Black and his team, as well as dealing with a shocking new development with Ben Lockwood. Dun dun dun. Alexis Ostrander directed the episode, written by Eric Carrasco and Adrita Mukherjee. What did we like about this episode?
the Elite, first of all, their return with the vengeance of Manchester Black and his Elite team finally forming up and really kicking off in this episode was one of my favorite parts. I really liked the introduction of the Hat, and I thought that he used his powers in a really cool way. Like, I just thought, like, how they work with, you know, the endless amount of things you can pull out of his hat. I think that's a pretty cool set of powers to have. And then even, like, Menagerie, like, her introductory episode, she was a little, like, meh. But within the team, she seemed, like, less awful, so that's good. I think, like, even, like, Menagerie, just her character works better within the group. I liked how their first foray into social media and using it as, like, a weapon, she was, like, scolding, like, Manchester Black on his camera angle. Like, you don't take a camera angle from down there. And, you know, like, the whole, like and subscribe. And she's definitely, like, their social media manager. So I think they just kind of, like, click as a group. And just Manchester is, like, firing at all cylinders this week as well. Like, I really don't see, like, I don't know if, like, the writers are trying to, they want you to dislike the Elite because they're those quote-unquote bad guys, but I don't see how that's supposed to happen for me when, like, Manchester is saying things like, you know, he's got a girl yesterday, he's telling Johnny has bigger fish to murder, when they go low, she goes high, we put them 6 feet lower, you know, and then him calling Ben Lockwood the Grand Bloody Wizard of the Children of Liberty, I thought was, like, really, you know, like, that's, I feel like that's the most straightforward and obvious they've been about, obviously, like, there's, like, some parallels between the Children of Liberty and the KKK, but calling Ben Lockwood the Grand Wizard of the Children of Liberty, I thought was, like, the most straightforward that they've been yet, in drawing those parallels. And then his, even, like, his weird let your people go Moses moment to Kara, I enjoyed. I liked him shading Kara, like, during his speech, and, you know, he's like, I imagine she's got her getting huffy with her hands and her hips for justice or something like that, and that's exactly what Kara's doing, and she is really happy about it. So the fact that he, like, get her spot on and just causes, like, all of this, like, frustration and annoyance for her, both Kara and John. Let's see. I'm a little sad, like, the honeymoon bromance between John and Manchester is dead, but it did get replaced with Manchester and the Hat. So, cheers to that, because I like their dynamic. Their dynamic was really cool, too. You could tell that they've been friends for a long time, and then both being British, they kind of, like, vibe off of each other. And then the weird Moses analogy aside, I love the meeting between Kara and the Elite in London, and how Manchester tries to reasonably, in my opinion, split up his superhero territory, and let Kara, like, take all of the boring bank robberies and, you know, cats stuck in trees and all this kind of stuff while the Elite take out, like, the actual alien-hating races. Like, I feel like that was a good deal, Kara. Like, you just took that deal, just saying, you know what I mean? So, like, Brain Niara, Cardoxia, however you want to, like, chop up that OT3. The field trip, I thought, was really cute. Kara's whole key is subtlety, superhero 101 lesson in Nia, immediately being met with Brainy's, like, incredibly loud fashion choice of a shirt, and, like, Kara's, like, incredulous reaction to it was a really nice contrast and great comedic timing between the three of them. And I wanted to say this, like, last episode as well, but, like, Brainy and Kara are kind of, like, the superhero parents who have adopted Nia into their family. Because she has two really good mentors that both want the best for her, even if Kara is just as absent as a superhero mentor as she is as a co-reporting mentor. Because I thought it was weird that she just, like, got them to the fortress and then, like, left immediately afterwards, but whatever. The chemistry between Lena and Alex had nothing to do with the lab space that Lena is occupying in the DEO. Like, the real reason that Guardian Corps broke up was for Agent Corps to rise. And I guess, like, Lena was, like, serious about working for the government. Because I thought she was just, like, lying or whatever. But I still think it's a super reason that for them to break up, for her and James to break up. But that's another comment for another section. And then I think, like, you know, other parts of the episode, like Supergirl confiding in Alex about being between a rock and a hard place with the Children of Liberty and the Elite. Alex, of course, teaming up with the Super Friends. Kara pitching the Lockwood Ain't Shit after Lockwood Ain't Shit article to James. I thought, like, I liked her persistence in getting all these articles out. And then Brainy and James do brunch. And it kind of makes me wonder if Brainy had to clarify with James that it was definitely not a date because he's had mistakes before.
LOL.
That is all my likes.
I like your likes. I also like Menagerie's like and subscribe shtick. I thought it was pretty funny, and I enjoyed the fact that we got the Elite in the first place and how they all worked together. I also really enjoyed the fight sequences this episode, especially once Alex joined the fight at the end. But I thought that they were really well done, and I liked seeing how everyone used their powers or their strengths in different ways. Plus, I just liked that, you know, it was the Elite and the Super Friends. I liked that there was actually the youth of Super Friends there. I'm also, you know, happy to see Lockwood being explicitly compared to David Duke, pretty much. And, like, the parallels for the Children of Liberty are much more obvious than ever before. So anyone that's still sympathizing with them can, you know, stop doing that. Because this is one case where fiction and reality very much coincide. And you can't say it's just a show. Since they were pretty much hitting us over the head with the metaphors this time around. I liked the trio of Kara, Brainy, and Nia, of course, and I liked the face-off for the, you know, the little swipes at each other that Brainy and Kellex were doing at the Fortress of Solitude, like the battle of synthetic beings. I liked seeing Brainy train Nia. I'm glad, and also, like, that little, like, fight they were having about her descendant, like, didn't turn out poorly. I'm glad that he recognized that it's all part of her heroic tendencies that he can nurture into making her a better hero. Yay. I really loved Alex this week. I loved her working with Supergirl. I loved her worrying about, you know, the position that her job was putting her in. I liked her realizing the government was using the DEO. I liked her wanting to help Lena, you know, and them, like, sort of forming their little secret pact. She was getting everything done. She was shining in every storyline. And I totally agree about the chemistry between Lena and Kara. Ha ha ha. I do not agree about that because it does not exist anymore. I'm talking about the chemistry between Lena and Alex was quite surprising. And I want more of it. Yeah. Can't wait to see more of their plotting together. I was happy that even Haley seemed to come around. Like, it seems like she might be standing up to Trump 2.0 in the future, too, once she realized that she had been played. So, yeah.
Yay. All wonderful likes, ladies. I also really liked Lena and Alex's chemistry. I didn't expect it, but it was really welcome. And I like the idea of Lena and Alex working together against the government. It was also nice to know that Lena didn't reveal all her secrets to them because she knew not to trust them. So that kind of cleared up a bit of the reasoning behind her decision, but not everything. I really do like the fact that the show is continuing with the plot thread of that one journalist who is going to find out all of Lena's secrets, and that James seems to really be debating whether or not he should let her run the story. I think if they do it correctly, they can show how ethics in journalism is always a tough thing to do, especially when you're really close to the subject matter. And I also appreciate the fact that Kara continues to write stories on Ben Lockwood and how you know, shitty of a person he is, and complains about it to James. And we've consistently seen her at work this season, so that's really nice and refreshing. Even if it's, like, in small bursts. I really liked the return of Manchester Black and all of his witty lines, and I have to say I liked the Elite a lot. I think despite some of their methods, they had, like, a lot of style, and I like that Manchester Black knows how to get on Kara's nerves without even being in the same room as her, which is impressive. Like, his little moment when he said that the Girl of Steel probably has her hands on her hips was great, because it really did showcase her reaction and how much he knew about her already. Plus, like Jess said, like, I can't really hate them because they are doing what they feel needs to be done against a hate group, you know? And then I also liked Menagerie this time around much more than the first time, and I really liked Hat with all of his trickery and magic. I also thought it was clever that the Elite were using the Moray to get information about what was going on within the White House, So, like, in just one episode, they managed to show that they are really dedicated to taking down the Children of Liberty and have a lot of intel that even the DEO and Colonel Haley did not have. And finally, I really liked that Kara came to Alex as Supergirl. It kind of reminded me of Barry cheating and going to talk to Iris as Flash in season one. And I like that she confided in her, and Alex didn't turn her away, but instead took the advice to also follow her gut and do what she felt was right. So in general, I think the writers have been finding clever ways to have them interact, even though Alex still has her memory wiped. But what do we not like about this episode?
Tati, did you mention, like, the fight scenes is, like, one of your likes?
Me, I did.
Yeah, I thought so. That's like, when I was watching, like, the episode, I actually wrote in my notes that they could use a little more James Bamford. Because I still think their fight sequences are a little hit or miss sometimes. But, you know, it's okay. Well, I like that Brainia started to train together. I thought it was, like I mentioned earlier, I just thought it was really weird that Kara's, like, literal only job was to give them the keys to the fortress and then bounce. I mean, did she really need to cancel her lunch with Alex for that? Like, I don't really, you know, I wish she could be more involved in that actual training dynamic. So, like, the tension between Brainy and Kellex has no show context for me to really understand, like, why they dislike each other. That, I mean, you know, it provides some kind of comedy, but there's no in-show contact to, like, Kara just had one line mentioned about how Lois introduced Brainy to Kellex, but we never saw that during the crossover, so there's no really way for me to connect what their problem is with each other. And then Brainy's disagreement also seemed really weird and forced, since apparently in the end, Brainy wound up not really having a problem with Nia going behind his back at all. So, like, was that the point? Was she supposed to go behind his back? Like, was this a test? You know, why go out of the way to have Kara leave him alone? Oh, yeah, that was the other thing. Like, the fact that, you know, the last time it was, like, the Valentine's episode and something was supposed to happen and didn't happen, and then this time, you know, you go out of the way to have Kara leave them alone, and then they don't have a moment at all. And so it just seems even more platonic. Their relationship seems more platonic now than it did after the Valentine's Day episode. And as opposed to, like, less platonic. So I don't know. They still don't really know what they plan on doing with any of that. The whole side plot with Ben and the president, you just throw that away. Like, I don't really feel bad for Ben feeling, like, out of place or fish out of water now that he's traded in his, like, hood for, like, a business suit. President Baker wanting to use a satellite to shoot down any alien ships coming into Earth, regardless of whether the aliens are dangerous or not, is just really despicable. I really felt for Kara during her talk with Alex. But I think this goes back to the title of the episode, which is, like, the morality question and the question that Shang brought up last week about superheroes not being allowed to do, like, the gray area things. Because I feel like Kara shouldn't really feel bad or conflicted about destroying the satellite. There's this kind of, like, wishy-washy message that I'm sure the show will probably end the season on, that, you know, kumbaya and all this bullshit. And, you know, understand your enemies and understand Nazis, they have a point, kind of, you know, crap. And it's just, like, annoying, because to affect social change in real life, you can't really all sides the situation, which is what Supergirl is definitely, like, trying to do. President Baker making Ben the head of Alien Affairs is just, like, the most disrespectful, racist slap in the face and we do. I felt it. Like, I felt, like, disrespected outside the show. Like, I'm making part of the show and I felt disrespected that Ben Lockwood is the head of Alien Affairs. And you will probably never see any of it or very little of how that decision affects, that the president made, affects aliens, not named Kara and her friends. So, you know, probably get, like, the elite's feelings, but then there's also supposedly supposed to be the bad guys. So, like, is there no alien lawmakers or politicians or, you know, anybody who would have a problem with this? Like, you know, that the president is just naming someone a racist, an alien-hating extremist, the director in charge of alien issues. Like, where's the supposed, like, tension from the alien side? We're probably never going to see that, and it's something that I think is missing from that whole storyline.
You're very right about that. The fact that it's not, it's missing the, you know, like, obviously naming a flaming racist to a position that requires you to not be racist is straight out of, you know, the daily news. But in our life, we have people protesting that very vigorously, and does not seem to be the case on Supergirl, aside from Kara not liking it. So it would be helpful to flesh out the whole situation and not just the Children of Liberty side of things. That being said, some of the analogies this episode were a little bit like, just like a little bit too much, a little over the top. Especially Supergirl and the aliens being like Moses and the Jews. I was like, wait, what? How do we arrive here? Also, I understand that Kara does not know which way is up. Like, she doesn't know what's going on right now, but like Supergirl doesn't seem to know which way is going on right now. Or what is going on right now. And Jessica already said that. But, you know, like, the Children of Liberty are bad. The elite is bad. The government is the worst. The president is the devil. So, like, you know, what is it? What can you do? What can a Supergirl do? We don't know. We don't know. There's, like, it seems like no one is right except for, I guess, in Supergirl's mind, Supergirl is right. But she doesn't know what's going on, so she's not right either. All right. Great. I also, yeah, it feels like, kind of feels like we're going a little bit in circles. Like, I don't really feel like the plot is advancing anywhere. I guess now that Haley knows that the government is on her side, maybe things will go somewhere. But anyway, the start of the Brainy and Nia argument was super weird and random to me. Like, I didn't understand why she was so adamant about knowing her future descendant and why this had, like, snowballed into them being, like, snippy with each other. I was like, when did we have the conversation where they wanted this to happen? And then it was resolved so easily. Like, I was glad it was resolved, but I was like, why did this happen at all? Other than just, like, to waste a couple minutes of screen time. I don't know. And I also agree that, you know, what are they doing with the relationship? Is it just friendship? If so, why did we waste those episodes on the crush that may or may not be real? And if it's not, then why aren't we moving forward? I don't know. Finally, if Lena doesn't trust the government that she's working for, why did she jump James for not trusting the government? I don't understand. Was she trying to protect him? If she's trying to protect him, why was that not explained? I guess it just explained by her sad face? I don't know why, and I don't know why she didn't tell him, because it would have made more sense for her to explain to him what she's going to do so that he doesn't end up exposing her ass with his decision to finally do good journalism. So...
And that's going to be, like, the other thing, because, like, he's going to do that because he's going to be good journalism, and then she's just going to just tear them apart even more.
Exactly. Maybe if you could just explain what's going on instead of throwing him out of the car, that would be better. But anyway, so there you go. That's my dislikes.
This is not necessarily a dislike, but I personally fooled myself into thinking that Kara bailing on Alex for lunch meant that Kelly Olsen was going to walk right into James' office at that moment and have a nice meet-cute with Alex, but that never happened. And I was just like, as soon as she left, she's like, oh, gotta go. And I'm like, ooh, is this the moment? But that did not happen. Anyway, on to actual dislikes. It was really weird that Kara didn't stay to help train Nia, like you said. She just... showed them the way to the fortress and left, which honestly she could have just, you know, shown them how to get there because she has Cisco's like breach device or whatever. Like, she could have just breached them there. She didn't have to take them. So I thought they were going to start using the fortress as their new DEO style headquarters, but that didn't really work out. And I thought that Nia's need to find out about her descendants was really weird given the fact that the storyline didn't happen until this episode and hadn't been mentioned at any point beforehand. I think we can chalk it up to the fact that maybe Nia was scared about her powers and wanted to know that everything was going to be okay, but they played it off that she wanted to learn some things about her powers, and that didn't make sense within this storyline. Yeah, so it didn't make sense to me. Also, they seem to have dropped the ball completely on Brainy and Nia this episode, because just like Jess said, they didn't even bother giving them a moment when they ended up being alone with the Fortress of Solitude. Like, so, like, what was the point of Kara dropping them off and leaving them behind if nothing was going to happen? It just made it seem like all of that Valentine's Day stuff ended a storyline that never even got started to begin with. And I was so sure about the ship before, and now I don't know how they're going to move forward. And I think writers are to blame for being so wishy-washy in their execution. And I think this episode was supposed to make me feel sorry for Ben Lockwood for struggling in Washington, D.C. and calling his wife all sad because she won't return his calls, probably because she's mad at him for trying to put their son in the line of fire. But clearly, I do not care about this asshole, and no one should. And I
think, you know what? She's probably mad that she's like that, whatever that racist dude was in D.C., that he's, you know, I don't know. That she's, I don't know.
That he's a sellout now?
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't even know if they're going to expand on it, to be honest. They just want.
They won't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that the show has likened Lockwood and his band of merry men to the KKK before, but this episode more clearly did it. But I don't appreciate the fact that he was still given a subplot and we were seeing his perspective and being mopey and the struggles he was going through in terms of leadership and power and where he stood now that he was out of jail, only for the president to deputize him at the end of it all. And I know that the writers are trying to draw a real life, you know, real life comparisons, I get that. They continue to do it in a way that is overt and problematic because they made the efforts of the DEO and even Supergirl this episode seem more urgent in wanting to bring down the elite, not the Children of Liberty. So they constantly act more angry about the elite than they have been about all the stuff the Children of Liberty have done and will probably do in the future. And I don't think it's enough for Kara to just say that she's writing a lot of articles to make sure that everyone knows about Ben Lockwood. And that he's a terrible guy, because that's all happening where we can't see it. Whatever. I just think that the writers need to try to make the aliens more active in the plot rather than just showcasing Ben Lockwood constantly. Finally, I didn't like that Kara still felt guilty about the satellite and had to lie to the president about destroying it, because that satellite was aimed at killing aliens before they even landed on Earth. So she had every right to be angry about what the government was doing. It's her job to question them, you know? And I think she should even write an article about it so that people know, because the whole fight with Children of Liberty still feels like it's in a bubble, you know? It doesn't exist outside of that. And also, now that we know Lena still distrusts the government and she didn't start working with them to protect James, the Guardian Corps breakup makes even less sense. What do we predict for the future?
I mean, I guess I'm, like, with you, like, Kelly Olson, where art thou? Lex Rise next week, and honestly, if they're going to introduce him anyway, I feel like they could have made Lex director of Alien Affairs, like, because that is kind of more in line with how he operates in the comics, as far as, like, being, like, a bad guy, but also being, like, a politician, and I feel like as a villain, he could pull that off better than what they're trying to do with Ben, but, you know, anyways, you know, Eve magically reappearing this episode, the episode right before Lex appears, like, I don't know, like, maybe Shang predictions matter, because I did not think that it was connected, but, you know, I guess when Gear Rise next week, we'll see. Or tomorrow, I guess.
It would have been better overall for the storyline if they had made Lex the one that's, like, you know, being the face of the anti-alien movement, because his motivation is already built in. Like, anyone who knows Superman mythos knows why Lex would be like, I don't like aliens.
Yeah.
And then you wouldn't have to spend all this time with his backstory. But oh well. That being said, the only prediction I have is one we've already discussed, which is that James is going to expose Lena by doing some good journalism. And then they will be irreparably broken because he will have inadvertently messed up the thing that she actually wanted to do, which was probably a good thing, but she didn't explain it, so.
Yeah, exactly. All right, moving into Arrow. Diggle and Lila deploy the Ghost Initiative. After months of covertly pursuing Dante, Diggle and Lila finally have a solid lead on the elusive terrorist, so they deploy the Argus Ghost Initiative to apprehend him. Meanwhile, Oliver tries to bond with Emiko, and Felicity tries to get back at Diaz, and also tries to keep the secret of her pregnancy from Oliver. Marcus Stokes directed the episode written by Rebecca Belletto and Gene Wong. What did we like?
Well, I liked Oliver making attempts to be in Emiko's life, like, even if he was overstepping, like, a lot in the beginning. I like that he's still, you know, just making, like, the effort that he wants to have his sister in his life. And then I also like that Renee is still the person that Emiko trusts the most, and therefore the bridge between Oliver and Emiko. I think he gave, like, some really good advice, both on Oliver's situation with William and his situation with Emiko. You know, just, it, they've come like a long way in their relationship, Oliver and Renee. So I feel like it's a really good vibe right now. And I like that Oliver's kind of test this week was, you know, learning patience. That was like the key word. Like, if it was like a Sesame Street episode, like, key word is patience. And it's because it's not like a character trait that he normally takes advantage of or uses a lot of, you know, because he's not like a very patient person. I don't think anyone would describe Oliver as patient. But I do like that he did recognize that he was overstepping, and he apologized to Emiko later on for doing so. So I feel like that was, even from a season or two ago when they had the whole OTA, NTA fallout thing, because Oliver was trying to, like, control everybody and everything. So I feel like that's also kind of shows how far that he's grown, that he, you know, he was about to fall back into that same pattern of trying to, like, control the whole situation, but he recognized that's what he was doing, with the help of Renee, and he apologized to Emiko. So I really like that. Oliver and Emiko's relationship in the present and paralleling that with Mia and William's newfound sibling connection in the future was also great. The whole, because I think that the episode is titled, like, Brothers and Sisters, so it was really nice to see those parallels in the present and in the future. Mia is also, like, impatient, and she doesn't really work well with others, so that's kind of like her dad, but she also only has, like, one person that she kind of trusts, so she's also like her aunt, and that she has Connor. And just as Oliver has to work to prove himself to Emiko, William has to try to do the same thing with Mia, to varying degrees of success. I think the parallel works well in the episode, but I do kind of feel sad at the same time, because there is one thing, if there's one thing that you can say about Oliver Queen, watching the show over the past 7 seasons, is that, like, one of his best relationships was his relationship with Pia, and now he's trying to build that with Emiko. So, like, Oliver, as, like, the big brother, loves his little sisters, and that's, like, one of, like, the true, like, genuine kind of relationships, and you say that he is a good brother. And I feel like he would feel that it was sad that William and Mia never kind of had that relationship, because I feel like, you know, if he lived a long life and had kids, he would want his kids to, you know, have, like, a good sibling relationship. So it's kind of sad that they don't have that at the moment. I am proud of myself for calling it on Connor, because I even got one up on Tasha, who's like, yes, mind explosion. Because I figure, like, you know, there's no way that can be JJ, because he's got to be at least a decade older than Mia. So it is confirmed that Connor is Diggle's adopted son. So either, like, I don't know if, like, Lila got JJ in the divorce, or OTA is a thing about upgrading kids for new kids. I don't know. But it makes total sense that Diggle's kid and Alyssa's kid would be BFF or attached to the hip in the future. I like how that bond is also reinforced in the present, that kind of OTA bond, with Diggle finally growing a conscience and prioritizing his friend's feelings for Diaz over Diaz and the Ghost Initiative. Also, Diaz is dead. Like, hallelujah. Let's throw a party. It was long overdue. So, you know, I'm very glad that he seems to be definitely, definitely dead. Finally. It was so satisfying to see him just go up in flames. Like, good riddance. Goodbye. Thank God. Perhaps my favorite part of the episode, though, was Felicity and Laurel. And their friendship has just been really, like, really enjoyed watching them kind of connect over their shared hatred of Diaz. And that's how that's now blossomed to, like, a fully formed, like, friendship. Like, Laurel has this very, like, tough, hard outer shell. She's just very soft and sweet on the inside. And I love that Felicity was able to kind of, like, bring the softness out of her a little bit, and you can see that in how she, you know, she's the first one that Felicity tells about her pregnancy, and, you know, then, like, Laurel gets, like, all soft and, like, brings, like, all these, like, healthy foods, like roasted turkey and stuff for the baby, and kind of, like, gives Felicity some encouragement. And I like that when Felicity brought up Operation Kill the Yes to Laurel and that she was in like kill mode, Laurel is also like hesitant about it because she's realizing now that she has things in her life that she actually likes and that she doesn't want to lose. Like, she's not as transient as she was in the past where she just kind of didn't care about anything and was kind of floating around. Like, she has like Black Siren is putting down like roots in Star City, and I'm like really proud of her. Yeah, I like that for her. So, yay Laurel.
Yay Laurel indeed. I also like that for her. I like the balance that Oliver and Felicity have achieved this season, but especially this episode. He was honest with her, you know, about his plan. He went to her for her approval, and he also, you know, was willing to accept her decision on what he should do as well as what she wanted to do with Diaz. I also love the moment where she told him that she was pregnant. I thought it was really, and it was fun how he picked up on the children hint. He's like, children? Oh. Like, I feel like I would have just been like, yes, in the future we will have children. But he was like, aha, we have children right now. But yeah, it was a sweet moment. I also loved Oliver trying to connect with Emiko in the present and how it was paralleled with William trying to connect with Mia in the future. I was glad they both wound up being successful after a couple of false starts. And I totally agree about, like, you know, one of Oliver's biggest strengths is being a good brother. And so I like that he also learned about himself through Emiko and then managed to give her the space to make her own mistakes, basically. After at first wanting to sort of like curate her life for her. Also, I loved Renee being the voice of reason for the Queen siblings and the bridge for them to help connect with each other. I'm really liking, I like Renee all the time, but I'm really liking Renee this season and how he's gotten to a place where like he's, I guess, respected in the narrative, which makes me happy. Well, we'll see about the future, but for now, in the present. Also loved Laurel, love of my life this week, another voice of reason. Her friendship with Felicity is really, really sweet. I like that she talked frankly with Felicity about her fears and sort of tried to get her to see reason. And also that she was the first person to find out about the pregnancy and helped keep it a secret, as well as provided some baby foods, or, you know, healthy foods for a pregnant lady, I guess, you know, to get her mind off murder. Could be, she could write a book, I guess. Healthy foods for a pregnant lady to get her mind off murder. Okay. John Diggle, finally, choosing his friends over his career, taking Diaz in, taking the fall for his wife to protect her career. We stand once again. This is the John Diggle that I love. So glad that he is back. Definitely, this episode, for that alone, this episode would be glorious. And then, finally, Diaz is dead. Thank God. I'm so happy. Ding dong, the witch is dead. So, another reason this episode is glorious. Dante, you know, I don't have that many thoughts on him right now, but I do love that his sidekick is named Virgil. That is a plus. Because you guys know why, right? You're just making blank faces at me. Okay. Dante Alighieri, right? He wrote the Inferno, right? That's what the Ninth Circle is about.
Yeah.
And the narrator is also Dante in the book, and he is guided through hell by the poet Virgil.
Oh.
Skip that day and
I read the book. It's just like been so long. I must have also remembered. I didn't remember the names. Beautiful.
All right. Anyway.
I also really liked Laurel this episode, and I think that her and Felicity have really come a long way in terms of their friendship, and I like the fact that the tie that binds them together is still their plan to take down Diaz, but I like that Laurel admitted she was pretty good at being a DA, and that's why she didn't want to mess that up by trying to take down Diaz, because that means losing that. So she's really turned over a new leaf, because revenge is not the first thing on her mind anymore, and that's major character growth, and I like that she was there for Felicity as a friend, and that she promised to keep her secret about her pregnancy, but that she was also trying to relieve her of the stress and fear that haunted her throughout this episode. I also think Oliver has come a long way as a husband since the beginning of the season, or even the end of last season. Before, he wasn't as trusting or willing to let people in, and in many ways, Felicity Like, he kept Felicity at arm's length when it came to decisions that would affect her. But this episode showcased that he is capable of listening to his wife and made space for Felicity's feelings and asked about her, asked her about her choices when it came to Diaz. He was also there as a good support system. Amazing. It was also showcased that he's like a superior big brother and that he really wanted to let Emiko know that she wasn't alone in her fight and that really that he really wants to be in her life. And I like that he actually took the time to listen to Renee, which was unheard of before, and that Renee was kind of the sounding board for Oliver with regards to Emiko because he was the one that she trusted. I also like that Oliver did come to see why she was bothered by his need to get involved when it was her case and that it was personal for her. And I think that really paralleled well with Felicity's storyline with Diaz. And speaking of Diaz, I'm really happy that he's dead. I don't think I've been this happy over a villain's death in a long time, so the writers better not be fucking with us. And I like that they like the introduction of Dante because he immediately, you know, showed how powerful he was in terms of how having big, powerful connections and the reveal that he was also working with one of the directors of Argus and Emiko proved that. He's also he's already a step above Diaz in his dive off the balcony. I agree with Tasha, it was really great. I also found myself liking the flash forwards this episode between Mia and William, and I'm glad that they got a chance to bond over their shared lack of enthusiasm for their parents. finally, I like that Diggle and Felicity finally reconciled, and that Diggle put his friends and Lila first. Like, the fact that he took the fall for Lila was very responsible and mature because even though she was a part of the Ghost Initiative, he did start it up again behind her back. So I don't think she should have been fired over his decision. And that he let Dante go so that he could come back for Felicity during her showdown with Diaz spoke volumes too, and I like that. But what do we not like?
Well, like, yay Diggle for taking Felicity's side over Diaz and all, but like, suddenly the Ghost Initiative gets uncovered in this episode and canceled anyway, and I can't help but think, like, this whole plot and all the angst it caused was just like a waste of time. I mean, it certainly wasn't for Diggle's development to take a morality mental break at this point in time. Like, what was the point of him deciding that working with the person that's tortured my best friends is okay? He didn't really, I don't really feel like he gained anything from that. Like, was it worth Curtis quitting Argus and leaving? Like, I don't, was it worth that? Because I don't think he was. And, like, I guess, like, it brought Dante out of hiding, but I feel, I don't know, I feel like we could have done that anyway without the song and dance of the Ghost Initiative. Yeah, so, you know, yay, but, you know, we didn't really have to do all this in the first place, I feel like. And I, again, with Oliver and Emiko, like, it all worked out, and Oliver did apologize to Emiko. So I kind of, it's contrasting Diggle's thing, I actually liked how this worked out with Oliver, but, you know, I still didn't like the middle part where he basically like took over her whole project and like he only found out about it on accident through Renee. Like, she never asked for his help, but he kind of like barrels in anyway and pushes her out in, you know, the whole like big brother, you know, I've done this before, so let me take the lead. And brother or not, like the whole, even if it was like parent doing it to the child, like, I've done this before, I know what I'm talking about, I know best kind of thing, that would be annoying to anybody. So like that, you know, I like the story as a whole, but I would be lying if I said like I just still didn't find it annoying when he was like telling her to stay put and stay out of the fight, and only him and Renee were gonna go do it. So it's like, come on now, like, don't, you can't be surprised when she shows up and she's upset that you're basically taking over her whole revenge plot. I feel like as with regards to the future thing, again, you know, yay, William and Mia reconnecting, but I can already tell now, like, I'm already side-eyeing that now that they know that they're related, that Zoe and Connor will get none of the scenes, while William and Mia get all the scenes. I don't even think we saw Zoe this past episode. Connor got, like, a sentence, and then you never see him again in the episode, and he hasn't really gotten, like, a lot of screen time since he arrived, really. And I don't really see that increasing because it's just going to be like a lot of like William and Mia, unless we get flash. I know there's a flashback episode of Mia and her life growing up, and there's going to be like some memories of her with Felicity. I don't know if they will also be very Connor and Diggle heavy. Hopefully there is, because I would like to know a little bit more about Connor, especially since he's not JJ. But, you know, I am a little bit worried that the slant towards this one pair of siblings will outshine all of the other things going on, or get more screen time or more development than the other things going on. I mean, that they, you know, they're the children of the lead, so yay. But I mean, also, I would like to know some of the other characters, and I hope that that balance doesn't go away, or it will at least like balance out or something. I don't know. And then I, speaking of William and Mia, I get that Felicity is like in hiding and all, you know, like danger of Will Robinson, blah blah blah. You know, it's dangerous, but I still think it's a pretty shitty childhood that William and Mia never knew each other. You mean like Oliver has an excuse because he's dead, but like, I don't know, like telling, like never telling your kids about each other and leaving all these like complicated clues with half answers that maybe they'll figure out. I don't really know what the writers, I know they want to make it like the mystery and all this kind of stuff, but there's just kind of like a lot of like plot holes, and I don't really know what it says about Felicity yet or her state of mind that this it's devolved so far that William and Mia never knew about each other. Like even if William never talks to Felicity and Oliver again because of circumstances, why would Felicity never mention anything to me about a brother? You know, like, I don't know. It's weird to me. And just considering the kind of relationship that Felicity had with her mom, and that Oliver had with his parents, and that Felicity even had it with her dad, too, because he was a calculator. I just feel like more efforts could have been made for to, like, connect the family or make sure that their kids were okay once they were no longer around. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's bothering me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much that I didn't like about the episode itself. I thought it was a pretty good episode on its own, but I agree that there's lots of stuff by implication that's a little bit odd, especially the backstory with Felicity and the kids. Even in this episode, I think it's this episode, maybe it was last week, I don't know, but we saw Oliver trying to call William and not getting a response, right? He left a message with the grandparents or whatever. And then William keeps saying that Oliver and Felicity never contacted him again. So I'm like, how could that be that, like, the grandparents are just, like, malevolently trying to avoid William knowing that he was being contacted, you know? And then, like, after Oliver dies, why wouldn't William reach out to Felicity? Like, how is it that that's the last he spoke to Felicity and Oliver? And why wouldn't Felicity reach out to William? I don't know. It just seems, it's very, very, very strange. And also, this episode ended on the nice note of, like, Felicity, like, hope maybe overcoming some of her paranoia, you know, with Laurel's help and with Oliver's help and with Diaz being taken away. But clearly that is not the case. Clearly she becomes way more paranoid by the time that we get to the future. So, I don't know. Like, obviously, we're going to have to work towards a resolution in the future so that people can feel like there's a happy ending, you know? Like, or not a happy ending, but, like, a satisfying conclusion. Because right now, it's super unsatisfying to see Felicity getting better in the present and then knowing she gets much, much worse in the future. It's kind of weird. I don't like that. Also, yeah, I just think it's a shame. Like, they made the future so dark. So, it's kind of, like, gives me, like, original Star Wars trilogy versus the sequels vibe, where it's like everything got wrapped up in the present, thank god, oh wait, just kidding, it breaks down again a year later, and now here we are 10 or 20 years later and everything is garbage and we have to do it all over again. So like, that's what I feel like with the flash forwards, even though I'm currently liking them in and of themselves, just like I, you know, loved Force Awakens in and of itself. I just don't like that it means that all of the original trilogy's efforts were wasted. Anyway, aside from that, Dante is not yet that much more promising than Diaz. Like, just the fact that DS does not exist is, I guess, enough for me to be grateful. But right now I'm like, I was not like impressed with his opening episode. Also, the reveal that he's working with Emiko was kind of underwhelming for me. Like, I'm going to wait to see how it plays out. But I like watching the Ghost Initiative like meet with him and the whole like mystery of like, oh, who's working with him, or like, what does he know, or like whatever. Like, I could not have been more bored during those scenes. I did not need them at all. And I also feel like with Emiko, they went really deep with what, with her revenge plot and paralleling it to Oliver and stuff. So I don't feel like they needed the weird betrayal situation. And I also feel like, cause like that's obviously what it originally is like, but you know, if you're planning to betray someone or you're like working with a person that they don't trust or their enemy or whatever, isn't it like usually like you try to worm your way in, right? Like you try to get close to them and like you try to gain their trust, but instead she was like pushing Oliver off because she wanted to do things her way. And then he finally gains her trust. And then it's like, oh, surprise, she's actually working with Dante. So it's like, what?
Yeah.
This didn't go the way this did not go the way that I expected. But I guess, you know, whatever, we'll see. Maybe she's just working with him because she thinks it's going to help with her mom. And it's not, like, actually related to Oliver, you know? I don't know. Well, whatever, we'll see. Anyway, that was underwhelming. And that's it. That's it. I liked everything else.
I think she might have just started working with him because she didn't realize she was going to ever meet Oliver. So
right.
There,
like,
there wasn't ever going to be a betrayal to begin with for her, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, so even though I like the fact that Diggle and Felicity are on the same page again, I'm annoyed that it took so long for them to get there, for him to get there. And I agree that it's wrong for Felicity to have hidden both kids' existence from each other for so long. And even if we believe it was William's grandparents who kept him away from Oliver and Felicity, Felicity can hack her way through anything. So she could have found a way to contact William. Like, and they could have driven to see him. It's not that hard. So, yeah, that makes no sense. And it still makes their parenting seem questionable, protection or no protection. And I'd be forever mad if my parents had hid from me an entire sibling my entire life. Like, that's a whole other person that you missed out on. And I thought Team Arrow's thing was that they always look out for each other. So it's kind of like going against that in a way. And I,
well,
also think,
I guess, like, if you think about it, the only person that is looking out is Diggle. And so I guess in there, and like, OTA's mine, that's all they need. But it's still weird.
Yeah, because especially because they all have like the tattoos or whatever, the little thing that they all get together that Oliver also had at some point down the road.
Before he dies.
Yeah, before he dies. I also think of, like, Felicity sending William all the way to Lian Yu and back on some kind of like treasure hunt is really dramatic and unnecessary. Like, it just, you could have communicated him without all that. I don't know. I found it confusing as hell that Connor admitted he was adopted, too. Like, he seems around the same age as Mia, so I guess Diggle adopted a whole child and only Felicity and Dinah knew about it. And then, like, what happened to JJ? If Diggle and Lila do get divorced, it would have to happen soon. Otherwise, it's too convenient and shitty that they'd erase another one of Diggle's children just so they could have Connor.
And this time it's their fault, not Barry.
So these are, like, all not even nitpicks about the episode itself, except for this one where I agree with Jess about Oliver thinking that he was, like, trying to help Emiko when she made it clear early on that she didn't want his help. Because I got his reasons, but in trying to make sure she knew he was there for her, he did overstep his boundaries and acted like he knew everything without listening. And I guess now that we know Arrow is ending fairly soon, Curtis could have stuck around for another half a season, but, you know, whatever. predictions. Do we have any?
Well, I think Tasha had a few, but, like, just to get mine out of the way, like, all this time we thought Felicity were the asshole parents that abandoned William for Mia, when plot twist, it was William's grandparents were the assholes and kept them from him. Because clearly, like, Oliver's trying to, like, make a connection and keep his connection with William. So I don't really see, unless, like, the grandparents, and that would be, like, an easy way to kind of, like, absolve Felicity from blame or, like, William's rage or whatever. If it's actually, like, the grandparents that are tertiary characters that we don't even really care about are actually, like, evil ones. So I feel like that's something that they would do. And then also, since we are going comic booky, like, Emiko's mom is alive, and Dante is using her as leverage against Emiko to do what he wants. It would also really explain how Emiko is so highly trained for a girl that lost her mom, like, less than a year ago. Because that's one of the things that I thought was really confusing, is that her mom dies fairly recently, and suddenly she is, like, all of her level highly trained. So she had to get that from somewhere, and I think it's from Dante.
Yeah, that makes sense, that she has to do whatever she's doing in order to free her mom from the Ninth Circle. But that being said, it would be a shame, because they wasted so much time with the story of avenging her mother's death.
Yeah, and I'm concerned about Laurel in the future. I think she might be dead, or she reverted back to her old ways, which would be a shame given how much she's grown as a person, but I also think she could be working with Felicity, and that's why she's...
I'm going to go with that last one.
Oh, yeah.
I think that makes the most sense. Because we're seeing here how close they are and how much Felicity trusts Laurel, and vice versa, and also she's not getting closer with anyone else. So without Felicity, she'd have no reason to hang out with the others.
Mm-hmm. True.
That means my Diana and Laurel. But I do think... Whatever. I do agree with you that I think, like, Felicity would, like, need some kind of quote-unquote muscle, and Laurel could help her in that area, like the brain and the brawn kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I agree with that.
Do we have any nominees for our side A? Who do we pick?
Maybe Felicity, going in on the mission while pregnant and having the strength of will to not kill Diaz. Yeah.
Yeah, I think she would be a good one.
And Alex.
Yes. Definitely Alex.
That was very enthusiastic for Alex. All right, so Felicity and Alex for side A are Lady with Gumption nominees. Moving into side B, where we will discuss Flash, Black Lightning, and Doom Patrol, we have Bent But Not Broken / Pass is the Tits But the Future Birthy / International Strangeness. We'll start with the Flash.
What?
The ultimate showdown, when Gorilla Grodd attacks Central City, Barry and Team Flash find themselves teaming up with an unexpected ally to defeat him, King Shark. However, when they hit a snag, they bring in Dr. Tanya Lambden to try to reach the man behind the shark, Shay Lambden, who is also his doppelganger on Earth 1, and she was married to him. Side note. Meanwhile, Joe finally returns from Tibet and helps Iris cope with her PTSD post-cicada. Stefan, I'm not going to botch that name, directed the episode written by Eric Wallace and Lauren Certo. What do we like about this episode?
Tati, do you want to go first or should I go?
I can go first. Okay. Things I liked about the episode. Moving on. No, just kidding. I thought that Shay and Tanya were actually really sweet. I really did enjoy their storyline when it was isolated. I liked seeing... Even though it was a different actress, like, the fact that we knew that it was the same character from, like, season 2 or whatever, helped bring some nice continuity to the show. And I liked how we saw, or we, you know, we heard about, but also witnessed, like, that those feelings develop. And the fact that she was fighting against her feelings because it was her doppelganger of her husband, I thought was really interesting. Like, something that could be explored more, could have been explored more with, like, a main character, you know, over a length of time. But anyway... I thought it was, like, an interesting, like, premise, and I liked how much it humanized Shay himself, and how we got to see, like, a real, like, human behind the shark, and it gave some real stakes for the King Shark versus Gorilla Grodd fight, and it really made him having to return to being a shark, like, forever super sad. I was like, what is happening? Why did they do this to me? So I enjoyed that plot. I also, you know, speaking of the Manimal battle, I did actually think, you know, it looked cool. Like, we guys it was brought up in one of the feedbacks, you know, the father-daughter lightning throw was really cool. I would have liked more of it, but what we got looked nice. You know, I was like, yay, go King Shark. Aside from that, I really liked Iris and Joe getting a storyline together. It was thank God we have Jesse Martin back, first of all. So, like, that alone is a like. But the fact that he came back and was immediately concerned about Iris and reached out to her and helped her work through her problems is something that we almost never get to see. So it was really nice to witness them talking things out. And I appreciated that they gave Joe a real explanation for Jesse L. Martin's absence and that he got to talk about his own fears and how, like, you know, yeah, sometimes these things do take a toll, like even on him, who is a veteran police detective and has seen plenty of violence and, you know, horrors over his lifetime. But when it's constantly directed at you and your family, it can get a little overwhelming. And sometimes you just want to take the baby and go to Tibet, you know, sometimes you just can't help it. And that he sort of helped Iris find her own Tibet in the boxing, in the punching bag. So that was nice. And also, you know, I'm glad that we learned they have a group chat. I thought that was cute. Also, I did appreciate that even though, you know, the whole ethics, we're going to talk about the ethics of their ethics, really, in the dislikes, I'm sure. But I did like Barry realizing within the context of the episode and how they had set it up, they had him realize that he had overstepped or that he had, you know, acted rashly, and he apologized to his friends and they, like, made up. I liked that because I was like, it's nice when your hero can take accountability for their actions, even if you didn't agree with the argument they were having in the first place.
I agree with that, yeah. And is that the end of your likes?
Yeah, I don't got nothing else.
Okay. Well, yeah, like, I know, like, a lot of people were not feeling the Shape of Water thing, and it, you know, it is a little weird, but I think as characters, Shay and Tanya were ironically the best part of that A-plot. There wasn't a lot in that A-plot to stand, so, you know, but I did think that Shay and Tanya provided some of the best moments, even with Sherlock being unnecessarily shoehorned into their love story. The actors, the chemistry between the two actors made me actually believe in their complicated relationship. Like, I didn't need Sherlock to tell me that they had a complicated relationship. Just like the actor's chemistry himself and how they interacted with each other and, you know, the kind of inner turmoil that Tanya was going through working with her late husband's doppelganger on another earth and trying to, like, you know, fight those feelings, but also falling in love with the same man over again. I thought was very believable. And it also, like Tati said, made the decision, Shay's decision to revert to Shark permanently, even more heartbreaking for the two of them. And that was it from the A plot, really. Like, I mean, like, the King Shark and Gorilla Grodd, like, actual fight was, like, you know, I guess it's cool. I wish I could see more of it. You know, I don't know whose decision it was to take gray and black colored animals and make them fight during the nighttime. But, you know, the parts that I could see looked okay. In non-A-plot news, while I thought it was weird to have Iris and Joe completely siloed and never interact with any other characters, aside from, like, 2 seconds with Cecile, I do like that the show took time to explore Iris's PTSD. So it's like, once again, she's facing consequences for her decision to break into Cicada's house on her own. You know, so this, for anyone that was concerned when that storyline popped up, it's still going on. And so she is still dealing with the consequences of that. And that's what, like, character development and growth looks like, where you see, like, all of the aftermath of the decision that a character makes. And I like the subtlety as well of how the whole plot played out, because it didn't really come out and say, Iris is PTSD, but it unraveled slowly from her, like, wanting to switch conversations when Joe brings in Cicada, to her finding excuses to avoid Central City Citizen by saying that the pipes were bursting, and then for her Joe to actually, like, just flat out confront her in jitters and be like, what is wrong with you? So I like how that kind of gradually unraveled. And while I wish there could have been, a day debrief scene at the end with, like, Iris talking to Barry about, because they both went through, like, a lot of shit in this episode. Mm-hmm. Like, Iris working through her PTSD and then Barry struggling with, like, the ethics of to cure or not to cure. And I feel like as a husband and wife, they could have had, like, a debrief scene that would have made it even better. But I do, that aside, I do like that Jesse L. Martin's first episode back was Joe helping Iris and supporting Iris, like, emotionally. And that how the writers were able to connect his trip, quote-unquote, trip to Tibet to being about Joe's PTSD. So they used, you know, Jesse's very real medical absence to their advantage in tying that story of Joe in Tibet to an actual story with Iris going on. So I thought that was actually really nicely done. And then, of course, like, the boxing scene in the lab was great. And it's a powerful moment for Iris. And I think a lot of women to kind of regain their confidence and power. So I thought that was really nicely done. Too bad we probably won't ever see her boxing again, because the show will go back to pretending that Iris doesn't know how to box, or we'll probably never see it again. But I do like, for this one episode, how boxing was written in as a way for Iris to kind of regain her power. So I thought that was great.
Agreed. I absolutely love the subplot with Iris going through PTSD. Like you guys have said, like, after Cicada's kidnapping and attack on her, it offered her some great development. I was actually really surprised because I didn't expect them to ever come back to it. People usually suffer trauma on this show and no one ever really talks about it, especially since we've been let down before with regards to Iris talking about her feelings back in season 3. So I think this season has come a long way in showcasing her fears and that she isn't this indestructible being. Like, she has these emotions. And I like that she was being a little dodgy when it came to not wanting to go to her office. And I like the fact that Joe picked up on that and decided that she should box it out. Like, it didn't help to heal her completely because these things never really do, but it helped take the edge off. And I really appreciated him being there for her and that his explanation for why he was in Tibet made more sense because he felt burned out too. And like you said, it helped, like, give a reason for his long absence, given that we know that Jesse L. Martin was gone for medical reasons. So, like, Iris is a journalist and she's going to do what she's got to do, but that doesn't mean that the aftermath of her actions shouldn't have follow through. And I like that she was able to express herself and talk about all the things that she was feeling up after the time loop. Also, Iris boxing was really hot and it was like a nice callback to her boxing as a kid back in season 1. So I thought that was really nice. And I thought Cecile and Joe were really sweet for like the 2 seconds that she was there, even, you know, but yeah, I did like that they focus on Joe-Iris relationship because I like that we haven't really seen them truly bond in a long time. And it was nice to get back to that. And it was just nice to have Joe back because he is a sight for sore eyes. He's been gone for so long and his absence has been like felt. So just seeing him be regular old Papa West is always appreciated. And for the A plot, I really did enjoy the Shay and Tanya interactions. I thought it was great that they had finally discovered a way for King Shark to express himself and that she was the one helping him and was very passionate about his safety and the idea that he could be cured. And I thought their romance was really sweet and it was a little bit Shape of Water, but it worked within the fabric of the specific storyline. And I thought it was nice that they gave King Shark more of a redeeming hero storyline because he was a shark for so long and he was trying to atone for all of his sins, even if he didn't remember them. And I really like that they went that route because now he actually got to make the choice as Shay, as a human, to go after Gorilla Grodd and do something even at the risk of never being human again. So cue the Beauty and the Beast song. I think that they gave him a good redemption story within the span of the episode, better than what they've done or didn't do with certain characters on the show. And I was actually a bit sad that he had to turn back into a shark at the end. And then finally, I did like the brief moment that Barry got punched by Grodd Sisko, just because everyone was kind of acting really stupid and out of character this episode. So there's that. So what did we not like about this episode? Because I'm sure they're much longer than the things that we did like.
Yes, that is not a wrong, incorrect assumption. Things I did not like. Okay. So I can't stand Sherlock. Let's just say that. I can't stand Sherlock. And I cannot stand him just inserting his ass into every single scene between Tanya and Shay. Like, and he just, first off, the way that he was asking the questions when she's going through something serious, it was like he thinks it's like super funny or something, you know? Like, he comes in like, oh, what do you think is happening right now? Why are you crying? Are you crying because you're upset? Because your husband's gonna be a shark forever? Like, is that what it could be? Therapy. Yeah, like, exactly. And I was like, shut up. Shut up, Sherlock. I'm sure she can figure this out on her own. And then, you know, whereas I did appreciate Barry apologizing, I did not appreciate at the end when Tanya, like, thanks Sherlock for his help. And I was like, he was not helpful. You could have done this all on your own, please. Why was Sherlock here? I'm so mad. And I would have gotten it, like, no, I mean, okay, no. I won't even say that yet. First, I'm just going to say, when he was trying to compare, like, her trying to avoid falling for her husband's doppelganger because it feels, you know, wrong, it feels like she's replicating her husband, with him, like, purposely going out and finding every single doppelganger of his wife, I was like, these are very clearly not the same thing. You cannot say that what you're doing is okay because what she's doing is okay. Sap. So
yeah, it really seemed like he was trying to make himself feel better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's not. It's not. It's not okay. You're a weirdo, Sherlock. You're a creepy stalker. I don't. Just go away. Okay. So I hated all that. Now, I would have loved it, of course, if they had managed to connect the A and B plot and had Iris talk to Tanya about being afraid of things, you know, and, you know, she could have even brought in, like, you know, I would take any version of my husband and not the little version in the newspaper where he's just gone and I had to stare at this newspaper for lots of years. At least you have your weird fish version, you know, anything at all, just to connect the A plot and the B plot. I don't see why. It was weird they were so isolated, like, and it didn't, I don't understand why, like, even if you're not going to have a thematic connection, which you should, that's just basic writing, I don't know why they couldn't have had, like, Barry in the group chat checking in with Iris, at bare minimum, you know? Instead, she just had the little chat with her dad, like, her dad was the one informing her of King Shark vs. Gorilla Grodd.
No, it was Sisko.
It was Sisko?
It was Sisko. He posted the GIF, and then Joe said, "Grodd hate banana." Barry was in it, but Barry was not.
He didn't say anything. Barry didn't say anything.
Maybe he was in one of the other 78 messages on her phone. I don't know.
Yeah. So, but it was just like, I get why Joe said, "But Grodd hate banana," because 121.
Yeah.
He said he hated banana. I get it. But I would have sacrificed that joke for Barry to say something to Iris in the group chat. Anyway. Yeah, so, like, and like you said, Joe and Cecile were cute. But Joe and Cecile getting to have a cute little moment, and then the whole plot revolving around Shay and Tanya, and I was like, if only there was another ship on this show that you could give some attention to, but I guess there's only two, so... I'm glad that next week they'll actually interact, but, and I know that it hasn't actually been that long, because it's the hiatus, that makes it feel like it's been a longer time since we interacted, but it has been a long time since they've gotten to be explicitly romantic, so let's let it happen, so the thirst can be quenched.
And it's also felt like a long time, because we had the hiatus, and then the last episode he was barely in it, so it's not like they interacted.
Exactly. Exactly. Then, the rest of it was nonsense with the, like, everything I feel like about the ethics in this episode, the way that I guess Supergirl feels about, like, everyone in terms of the government and Children of Liberty and the elite, just, like, everyone is wrong, everyone's doing wrong things, so I, considering that they specifically said, let's get his consent before injecting him, it was wrong of Barry to do it without his consent. And also the fact that he was planning it in advance. He was going to do it anyway. So I was like, yes, he is wrong. This is bad. But also, why are Sisko and Caitlin even looking for a human being to test this on in the first place? you got this untested drug that you're hoping is going to do something big, but it could potentially just kill someone. You literally have no idea. And the first thing you're going to do is test it on a human being? What? And if you're going to test it on a human being, why isn't the human being you're going to test it on Cisco? He doesn't want his powers anymore. Test it on yourself, Cisco.
Die.
Yeah, right? It's like, why is your life more important than this other random human being that you're choosing's life? He wasn't even brought up. Like, so anyway, I thought this was just from the start. I was like, what is happening right now?
Why that would be funny if someone challenged, like, well, why don't you take it? He's like, it hasn't been tested.
Exactly. But like, seriously, like, hello? All human beings are created equal, even if they're half shark. Speaking of which, if they're half shark and you don't know how to account for the shark part of the cure, why are you using a half shark man to begin with? Shouldn't you be using a full man? Like, what is happening? Why don't you guys know how to test things? I learned this in like 8th grade because I didn't do science after that. That's not a lie. I did science in high school. I just don't remember any of it. Anyway, I just don't understand is what I'm saying. This whole plot was just stupid. And then they're arguing about consent when they had already agreed they were going to give it to Cicada. So obviously they were not planning on seeking Cicada's consent, especially when Barry just came up with the revolutionary plan to ask Cicada nicely if he doesn't want his powers anymore at the end of this episode.
Yeah. Like this whole cure plot was just like a hot mess.
Yes. So I just excise all of it. Just throw it all away. I would have rather watched just like a whole episode that's like other people's lives in Central City. And then we just like meet Shay and Tanya and the whole story was just about them. And then like Team Star Labs just didn't show up at all. And then King Shark fights Gorilla Grodd while Iris is boxing at with her dad. Done. Whole episode. And then Iris just texts Barry at the end. It was like, oh my god, I was boxing and I looked out the window and I saw Gorilla Grodd and King Shark fighting. Crazy. Okay, so then finally, aside from that, it was just, I was waiting the whole episode for the Versus, and then it didn't show up until, like, 45 minutes into the episode, and I get that they can't have that much, you know, they can't use that, even if they spent all their budget on just this episode, it still wasn't gonna be a, like, full-scale fight. Like, so I get that. But from the moment that he, like, ran off because of the interference or whatever, like, it was obviously Grodd. You know, he said he wanted to be cured. He was like, yeah, a cure sounds great. And then suddenly he, like, runs off. Like, probably something happened there. But they did not. And we even had, as pointed out to us in our feedback, Nora should even have thought, what if it was Grodd? Because don't King Shark and Grodd fight at some point? But no, this was not brought up. And then it took, like, 30 minutes for anyone to even think, like, oh, hey, Grodd is a thing that exists. And he is doing stuff right now. Also, like, why did it take so long for Grodd to do anything? Just in general, I mean, I don't mean like 30 minutes. I mean, like, since he's had the ability to do something, just now he's suddenly doing something. I don't know. Whatever. It just felt like a very, very long wait for not a lot of payoff. Okay. Now I'm
done. Yeah. Okay. Like, there's just so many kind of plot holes and just things that just don't make sense in this episode. The whole cure plot is just like falling into the pitfall of the season, not just this episode, but over this whole season, the whole to cure, not to cure thing has fallen into the pitfall of like flip-flopping on an issue to force it to fit the plot. So like Cisco wants the cure in what, like episode 5 or 6, Caitlin and Killer Frost don't. They compromise and say only use it on people who want to be cured. Then they decided, as a group, all of them decided to force the cure on Cicada. Like, the whole reason why Cisco was missing for episodes at a time was to make the cure. The whole reason Iris had to fight for her life and stab Cicada with a pin, like, the whole reason for that plot was to give the team the idea for the delivery system for the cure. The whole reason that Barry had to lock his ass in Speed Force and, you know, nor destroy the timeline 52 times was because Barry had to Speed Force cook the cure. And the whole reason that they rushed finishing the cure at all was to use it on Cicada. Like, there was no other reason to rush the timeline on making this cure other than using it to defeat Cicada. Because Cicada is a serial killer who's never going to stop killing Metis. And then in this episode, Killer Shark is literally also about to, like, bite off Cisco's head. Like, it's a life or death situation right here. So Barry makes an executive decision to give him the cure, force it on him, and now Cisco and Caitlin suddenly remember that they have a problem forcing cures on villains. Like, I don't understand. Like, why are you having, like, such an issue about it now? Like, why wasn't, like, as was mentioned in the feedback, why wasn't this a discussion that was brought up in an earlier episode, and then this episode, Barry does it anyway? Then they have a reason to be mad, you know? Like, if Barry brings up, we're going to use this on Cicada, and Cisco or Caitlin, like, no, we can't do that. And they argue about it over an episode. And this episode, Barry does it anyway. And then they have a reason to be mad. That would have made sense. But the way that they did it in this episode, just, and how they played out this whole thing, doesn't really make sense why Cisco and Caitlin now suddenly have a problem with using cures on villains. And that final scene where Barry tells them, like, I think we should ask Cicada if he wants to cure, guys. And Cisco and Caitlin, like, act like this is a new and bold and fresh idea. Like, oh, wow, you think we can do that? Like, what the fuck were y'all planning on doing with the cure before this? Like, you not planning on asking before? Doesn't that sound like forcing a cure on a villain? You know, so you're just, like, being hypocrites and upset that Barry, you know, is planning on doing this because the plot demanded it. Like, you know, okay, that's cool. Cool, cool, cool. Great. Whatever. Yeah. And then, like, at the end of the episode, like, everyone, I think this was either Rachel or Shy, mentioned their feedback. At the end of the episode, everyone agrees that it's a great idea to force Grodd into a medically induced coma. So, again, that's another, like, ethical situation where people are deciding for Grodd to just, like, strip him of, like, his consciousness, basically. And, like, how is that any less ethical than forcing a cure on... or any, like, more ethical, I guess, than forcing a cure on a villain who doesn't plan to stop killing. So, like, why is it okay to force Grodd into a medically induced coma so that he can't think anymore or use his powers, but it's not okay to force a cure on Cicada, who is a serial killer and won't stop killing? It's not okay to force a cure on King Shark, who is about to kill Cisco. Like, why is one okay and not the other? Yeah, I thought, like, with the whole King Shark plot, the caveat of him having, of Shay having issues between being a human or staying a monster forever was also stupid. It worked for the sake of drama, but, like, first of all, like Tani said, like, you hadn't even factored in animal brain chemistry. Why make King Shark your first test subject? Like, that doesn't make sense. Also, making it so that if Shay took the, however they reversed the cure, because I wasn't really following along with how they plan on, like, turning him back into King Shark. But the fact that if he became a shark, that he would never be able to be human again after building a whole Tanya Shane thing, like, I think it was a cop-out for the sake of drama. Like, they just got through saying, like, how they didn't know how the cure would work with animal DNA. So if you didn't know that, and there's still a lot of things you don't know about this cure, why are you so sure that his condition will be permanent now? Like, I feel like if you take it away and then you give it back, you should be able to take it away again. Like, I don't know why it would work one time, like, a second time. That's all I'm saying. I don't know. I feel like Tanya and Shay didn't really deserve Team Flash butting into their lives. Like, Tanya and Shay, I feel like, are the victims here, and Team Flash is just, like, butting into their lives, like, building up their romance with Sherlock being annoying, and then, like, giving them hope and then taking it away again, like, oops, I'm sorry, and, you know, just, like, well, they have to kind of live, you know, with what they have now, because Team Flash, like, butted into their lives. They were doing just fine before Team Flash came and offered that cure. And I, like, speaking of, like, the romance and stuff in Sherlock, he was really useless and not needed to tell us things happening between Shay and Tanya that we could clearly see. And Tanya would meet, like, the audience and Tanya already know what she's feeling for Shay. Like, we didn't need Sherlock narrating the drama going out in that plot. And if they really needed another Team Flash member in this plot, I feel like Ralph would have been a better choice. Because, like, I know, like, someone said that they didn't notice Ralph was missing, but when Sherlock kept butting in to Tanya, I'm like, if they really needed, like, a Team Flash member to be a part of the plot, like, why couldn't it have been Ralph? I feel like Ralph would have been the better choice at this point. And honestly, like, why do Ralph and Cisco have to trade off episodes when they're not just often missing when there are other characters also not doing shit that never go anywhere and have to be in every episode. Like, I don't understand why it's only, like, Ralph and Sco. The Iris and Joe subplot I thought was great, but it's definitely weird that Iris and Barry are never even in this, share the same, like, space in this episode. And even with separate plots, they definitely could have and should have had a scene to reconnect over their respective days. And that's, again, like, one of those, like, thematic tying elements to connect all the plots with one central theme. They could have had that with Barry and Iris. Except what we get is Iris being filled in by a group chat with Sisko about King Shark versus Grodd and not her own husband. And, like, I don't, honestly, like, I get, like, the whole plot about, like, Iris and her PTSD, but, like, what the fuck were she and Joe doing that they didn't notice a gorilla and a shark man fighting each other in the middle of Central City? Like, I feel like that's something that a reporter should be in the middle of. So, like, I was kind of felt some kind of way that she was shocked that Ait and a gorilla king shark fight happened and she didn't know about it. It's like, you know, this is why Central City Citizen isn't, like, getting the clicks, because the reporter is late and doesn't know that there's a shark man and a gorilla fighting in the middle of the street. You know, like, the boxing match didn't take up that much time that she couldn't also notice that something big was going on in the city. And clearly they have a group chat, so why didn't anyone text Iris and let her know? Like, her phone, maybe it's one of those 78 messages.
The fight was so short.
That's the fight was so short.
It only lasted as long as her boxing match.
I guess so. Like, it happened at the same time. She didn't, like, miss it. I don't know. It just seems really ridiculous that something this big happened and there's not one connection to her getting a scoop for her paper. Anything. So, like, just in general. Because that was one thread, a Central City Citizen thread that I felt should have been carried on in this episode. But in general, The Flash has a lot of loose ends that's running out of time to tie up. So, like, Iris still needs to meet, you know, Camilla, Cisco's girlfriend, hired for Central City Citizen. Dude needs to appear, like, just appear. There's that Sherlock new potential wife that's meta plot that we don't know what's going on with that. Barry and Iris still need to, like, touch each other or, like, have sex or imply that they have sex. So, like, because if you don't see, like, the real reason that Moore is erased at the end of the season is it will have nothing to do with her changing the timeline 3 times in a single day. Like, it's not going to be that. That's not going to be the reason why she's erased, because, like, Barry and Iris are not having sex at all, or it being implied that they do have sex, never plan on having her at any point in the future. So, I mean, like, there's just, like, again, it's like the whole pacing issue that The Flash continues to have. And I definitely agree that there needs to be, like, a change in leadership, and there needs to be a change in writers' composition of the writers' room. You know, Arrow is leaving next season with a shortened season. Those writers are going to have to go. And they've done wonders for that show. So maybe, I don't know, maybe we can merge writers' rooms and 6B will truly be that bitch. Right now,
maybe Derek and Ben can come back. I mean, my dislikes are a lot of your dislikes. Goes back to the whole logic and moral compass guiding the whole cure plot, which has never made any sense. So, like, just said, you know, recap that Sisko wanted the cure. But what bugs me, I think, that at the end of, not only at the end of 512, we saw Barry come to Sisko and declare that he was going to use the cure on Cicato. Sisko nodded, so that meant he was in agreement and didn't have a problem with the lack of morals in a situation, right? And then in Goldface, Caitlin felt the same way, because Barry mentioned that he was going to give it to Cicato, and she didn't say anything. And then flash forward to now, where you have Caitlin and Sisko are acting like hypocrites because they're suddenly mad that Barry would even think about using the cure unless they asked the subjects whether they wanted it or not. And like you guys said, it just makes no sense. And there was never an instance in the show where Barry actually agreed with them that he wouldn't use the cure unless someone volunteered to use it. Like, that conversation between the three of them never happened. It happened between Sisko and Caitlin before it disappeared. And then when Barry actually decides to use it, they're suddenly mad. So it's just odd that in a storyline where it's science versus ethics, the show A suddenly has a problem with it when they did it in season one, locking, like, all those metas up illegally, for example. And then B, now that they're finally doing a science versus ethics storyline, they're not doing it in a way that's thoughtful or actually raises these questions because the writers just keep flip-flopping on where the moral compass has to point depending on what they need the plot to do. So it just feels completely out of character when the same characters who cared about one thing in another episode now don't and are then back to caring about it once again. And it also made the argument seem weird because Barry, even though he did want to use it to stop Cicada, did save Sisko's life, so in that instance it worked. And then Sisko was acting brand new at the end of the episode when Barry had made the same suggestion. So it just made Sisko seem like out of character as well. And it's comical to me that they think they could even ask Cicada to take the cure and it'll be okay. Like, because they're BFFs now or something and Cicada isn't a raging psycho. Also, Caitlin and Sisko deciding to put Grodd in a medically induced coma, like you guys said, made their entire argument against Barry just... what's the word I'm looking for here? Just, like, be ruined, basically. Bullshit? Yeah. No. Bullshit. They didn't ask Grodd for permission, obviously. And they've never asked anyone for permission to do anything. And all of a sudden, it's just weird that it's a whole issue. And I think there was just too much... schmiance in this episode for my liking. Like, there's a lot of it usually, but it was just to the point where I kind of zoned out because there was a lot of unnecessary exposition, and there was also no sense of urgency when it came to why Barry was so desperate to use the cure to begin with. I think that's what bothered me the most. Like, Cicada has proven to be an underwhelming villain so far, but with the storyline that they gave Iris this episode about fearing Cicada coming after her at her office or in her home to kidnap her or hurt her family, it would have made more sense for that storyline to tie into this episode and have Barry and Iris talk about these things so that there was a central theme, like you guys said. But then Barry's actions would have made more sense because if he felt that Cicada was now directly threatening his wife and kid, and he knows where they live and you know, all that, then the urgency would have been there and it would have felt more natural because Barry would have had a more meaty storyline, especially since he wasn't around last episode and not being there to protect Iris and Nora during that whole time loop and Cicada coming after them is probably a fear that he actually has. So to the writers, pick a lane and stay there. And it's not that hard to keep these moral arguments in check, and yet they're fucking it up pretty badly. Then Sherlock also annoyed me this episode. While it was played as sweet, like, they played it off as sweet that he was trying to draw Tanya and Che closer together, but he just kept butting into something that had nothing to do with him. So, first of all, he's the last person who needs to be giving anyone advice about love, with 7 failed marriages. Secondly, his intrusions and advice started to sound more and more creepy because he was trying to absolve himself from the guilt of loving his wife's doppelgangers over and over again, like Tati mentioned. So because pushing that narrative was really for his benefit, even if we got some nice moments between the Shape of Water couple, they would have naturally come to that conclusion themselves without Sherlock constantly popping in where he wasn't needed. So because it was about him, it was insincere, and that's how it came off. I just felt like the writers were trying to give him something to do, and his uselessness really showed in this episode. I would have appreciated, had he gone off somewhere off screen to investigate Nora, it's fine. And then finally, I'm not on the West Island needs to kiss every episode train, but the fact that they physically shared no scenes in this episode was really strange. So they were never in the same space, in the same room, and Barry seemed so cut off from knowing what was going on with her, which is annoying because if it had been flipped, she would have been there for him. And if she'd been around too, she could have actually made him see some sense as well. So all this to say that they both should have been there for each other, even though I won't begrudge some much-needed father-daughter time, but Barry and Iris being separated in this way made the episode seem off-kilter a little bit and more glaring because Barry was... where it was more glaring because Barry was also pretty much absent last episode. And I also have a hard time believing that Iris wouldn't have known that, like just said, about King Shark or Gorilla Grodd. Like, even Spin Zone would have had that story up before anything had gone down. So she would have been in the know, and she could have been in Star Labs and still had her subplot with the PTSD. Like, shocking, I know, but it could have been done. Anyway, do we have any predictions?
I didn't even bother. So, like, meh and underwhelmed by this episode. It's just like, no. It's the same as they've been. Nothing has changed.
Exactly. It didn't move forward, so.
All right. Well, then, moving into Black Lightning. Looking for answers, a worried Anissa sets out to Grace. Oh, that's it. These Black Lightning recaps.
That's all that happened in the episode.
Yeah. Lynn faces off with Agent happened. Odell.
Other big stuff happened in this episode.
Lynn faces off with Agent Odell, who tells her that he intends to weaponize Wendy and that she's being too mothering towards her. And then we have Lala, who is back from the undead again and is going after Jefferson for something that happened a long time ago with one of Jefferson's students. And mysteries are discovered. So, what did we like about this episode?
That was an excellent recap. I liked that. I liked the bottle episode portion with Lala and Jefferson. I thought it was really strong and emotional, and it shed light on both of their pasts and, you know, their character development. And it also, like, it didn't answer that many questions about Lala, but it did give us a better understanding of, like, how his tattoos and his hauntings work. How they are connected to, you know, his skills. I enjoy Jennifer and Anissa poking fun of Gambi's original costume for Jefferson. I like that little, you know, the family vibe we got. And combined with their fun little family dinner at the end, it really was one of the, I guess, like, few episodes this season, or at least ever since the Runaway arc, where it really felt like the Pierces were a family, and, like, a family that could be, like, happy together. I also love how excited Jennifer was to try out her new suit and how that excitement freaked out poor Lynn. And then I thought it was a, you know, like, then I felt bad for her when she was less excited after the fact, after nearly getting electrocuted. She's got, you know, after her previous reckless behavior, she's sort of starting to learn now that she can't actually just go running in half-cocked anywhere. So that's a good thing. I also was really glad that Anissa was not giving up on Grace. I like that Jennifer gave her that extra push, even if, you know, I don't agree with Jennifer's assessment of her love life, but I did like that she used it to help Anissa not give up on hers, and that we actually got to see that Grace is shapeshifting. You know, we've actually learned something about Grace, even if Anissa did not learn something about Grace. There we go.
Yeah. I know, like, some people thought this episode was a little out there and a little weird, but overall, I liked it as a contained episode. I was very happy to see not only Lala come back, but also have him be, like, the main focal point of the A-plot of Jefferson. And I feel like isolating Jefferson from the rest of the family and putting him in this, like, pressure cooker situation with an increasingly agitated Lala and Lala's peanut gallery of ghosts kept the tension for the first part of the episode for the audience, especially when at various points in other plots, family and friends are periodically trying to call Jefferson and they can't reach him. And they're just like, oh, well, maybe he's not available right now. And, you know, specifically, like, Lynn's paranoia in this episode about, like, safety with regards to Jan and her suit, and then her, you know, worrying about Wendy, and then she's like calling Jeff and mentioning in her voicemail to Jeff that she's, you know, not worried about him when she definitely should be worried about him at that moment, because we know what he's actually dealing with and the reason why he's not picking up her calls. So I thought all of that works very well for that first half of the episode. And then I also like how the whole Earl plot is a huge nod to the Black Lightning comics. And I can't remember, I feel like, I don't know if it's Black Lightning Rebirth or whatever, but I remember the whole Earl plot and, like, the kid in the basketball hoop and being the first person that Jefferson wasn't able to save, like, in his early superhero days. I don't remember if I remember that because I read that, or if it was because we talked about it when, like, Black Lightning was first being, I think we talked about it maybe when Black Lightning was first being brought on to the CW or something like that, but I just felt like it was a really good callback. So that part, and also Gammy bringing out Jefferson's, like, original 70s style suit design, I thought were just really good, like, comic nods. Within the episode, I loved LaWanda being, like, the angel on Lala's shoulder in contrast to Demon, which his nephew, whose name I don't even remember. I can't remember what his name was supposed to be. But he was just a dick the whole time. So I was really, really happy. And it felt really satisfying when LaWanda like literally beat his ass. So like, thank you. Shut him up, please, LaWanda. So I really enjoyed that. And I thought it was like really cool how Jefferson was able to react in this stressful situation with an unstable Lala and get Lala around to actually the real the truth of what happened to Earl and the reveal that it was actually Lala was the one that killed Earl and how that all played out. And, you know, him getting that other, a new ghost tattoo of Earl. And then you finally get to see how Lala was reanimated, because that was a big question mark in season one. So being able to see how it happened, even though it was kind of gross. The introduction of this new doctor guy is kind of cool. And I feel like I want to know more about him, because even though Lala was reanimated the first time, it's because Tobias paid the doctor to reanimate him. But Tobias kills Lala, and the doctor still like reanimates him like a second time, even after Tobias is done with him. And so, and the doctor's also like leading him back towards the trail of Tobias is the reason for all this, because he keeps like bringing him back. And Lala, why am I here? And he's the one that points Lala to Jefferson to get a background to Tobias. And so, like, Lala ending the episode, resolving to kill Tobias as redemption, feels like the beginnings of an anti-hero storyline, which I'm really here for it. And then getting back into the whole morality question again, it's obvious within the show, there's a lot of people that want to kill Tobias. Obviously, Jeff can't do it, and the writers are not going to let Jen do it, even though she wants to do it. They're not going to let her do that, because that would be, like, crossing a path. So Lala falls into that moral gray zone, because he's not a great guy. He wasn't in life. And he's also, you know, in death, he's not really working in this whole absolutely good center. He's in that gray zone. And being in that gray zone will allow him to kill the bad guy, but not compromise, like, the moral compass of the show. So I feel like that's how they're going to make it work. On the Grace side of it, even though Grace didn't get to be, like, in the episode that much, I like that there is now a consistent Thunder Grace storyline with Anissa searching for her. I don't really fully understand the mystery of her powers, like, how she got them yet, and the whole reason, like, why she's hiding them or who she's hiding from. But the intro of her brother, who may also just be Grace, I thought was a good surprise. And it led to a really nice fight sequence with Anissa, with Thunder, that shows the potential of Grace's powers and just how strong that she will be as an ally once they finally get back onto the same page. And I thought the twist at the end with Odell and his team being the ones spying on the Pierce family as opposed to Gambie, because I thought, like, when you see, like, the dinner and then you see them on camera and you see this, like, white hand, I'm like, that's weird, Gambie. Like, why are you being, like, creepy and... You know, was he not allowed to join the dinner at that point? So he was just, like, you know, teleconferencing.
Maddie wasn't invited to the dinner.
Yeah. He was, like, on Skype, like, joining by Skype or whatever. But, you know, in the end, it's, like, actually Odell. And I thought that was a really – that was an actual plot twist that worked, and I liked it.
It was really nice to see Jennifer be really happy. Like, her excitement over the suit made me really excited for her to be wearing the suit. And I think that her ideas for having it be a little bit more fashionable were cute and got her back to feeling a lot like she was a teenager who hasn't necessarily faced all these hardships. And I really like that we got to see Anissa feeling helpless and lost when it came to her search for Grace. But I like that she decided to be a little bit more proactive about trying to find her. And it was great to see Anissa research and finally find the lead and go after it. Suspect something was wrong and then tried again as Thunder, even when the old man, aka Grace, didn't want her to be there. And I'm glad we got to see Grace, even if it was for a little bit, and that we learned that she could shapeshift, which is something we didn't know before. It seems like she is and isn't in control of her powers, because from what I can tell, it's like her emotions that trigger the change, and that was really interesting to see, because the stress of the situation of Anissa finding out the truth made her lose control over being someone else. And I also really liked that Lynn stood up to Agent Odell and told him that she wasn't really going to allow them to use Wendy as a weapon. It might have gotten her locked out, but at least she asserted herself and didn't seem as intimidated by him as she had been before. And I like that little bit of development that we saw at the end with Lynn being able to discuss these things with Jennifer and Jennifer not reacting in a bad way or making her feel guilty because Lynn was trying to rectify the situation through her protection of Wendy. And I'm really happy that the show didn't forget about Lala, because whenever I think that the writers drop a plot, they bring it back, and that's really great. And I thought it was really interesting that we saw him come after Jefferson in a far more personal way. Like, Jefferson was at school grading papers and was just doing something that was normal and outside of his Black Lightning responsibilities, and in comes Lala threatening him. So it was really nice to see how Jefferson handled himself and kept his cool in a very intense situation without using his powers. So what did we not like about the episode?
What did we not like about the episode? I don't find Agent O'Dell compelling as a character. I'm like frustrated by like Lynn's attempts to help the kids constantly being thwarted. So like I just want to get to the part where she's able to be like a mother figure to these kids. Especially right now, Wendy, I guess. But so that's all. Like, even though like it was, I agree with Jessica, that was a good twist that he's the one that's watching, and also that like he obviously doesn't want the secret to get out. But I would just like to know what his goal is so that we can get to it being defeated. Yeah. Also, I didn't like that we only got to see like Grace for like a minute. And we're not actually that much closer to answers about her, especially like for Anissa finding out the answers. So I'm hoping that the fact that she was in the episode at all is a good sign that we're going to get some resolution this season. Because I know that we were thinking like, oh, well, she's just not even going to show up again until like the finale or something. And then we won't find out until next season. So hopefully this means we will get answers this season. But I'd still like it to move a little bit faster so that we do. And then I'm a little bit confused about Jennifer's progression. I like that she's learning to be more cautious, like I said. And I got that the costume scare brought her down a notch. But it was like, it felt super dramatic. Like, I don't know. Like, it was like, she was super excited, and then the costume malfunctioned, and then she was like so sad about it that she couldn't even like talk about it at dinner the next day. Or not the next day, but at the end of the day. And then it was like equivalent to like Anissa's failed search for Grace, and Lynn's like failure to protect Wendy, and Jefferson almost dying at the hand of Lala. And I was like, are all these things equal? I don't know that they are. I think one of these things is not equal to the other things. But yeah, so that's all.
Yeah, I feel bad because like I know that y'all are proud of Lynn and everything, and you know, want her to succeed, and I'm just not that sympathetic, and I don't, like, it started, like, a couple episodes ago. I don't know what it is. I feel like I've lost a lot of patience with her storylines, and I think it was, like, really during the Book of Rebellion that it started, and I just haven't been able to get it back. And while I agree that Odell is super creepy and that he absolutely does not care about the well-being of Wendy, I can't help but agree that Lynn just keeps coddling Wendy, and it feels like the writers are overly leaning on Lynn and motherhood as a personality trait, and that's all that she is, and that takes over everything, that outweighs Lynn, the doctor, the scientist kind of thing. And like she was on a scale of like 1 to 10 with Wendy and trying to help her with her powers. Like, she wouldn't let Wendy go past a 2. Like, if they were bowling, Lynn would insist on keeping the bumpers up and like having Wendy wear protective pads and all this kind of stuff, and a helmet maybe to actually like bowl or do anything remotely fun. And she's not really doing much to help, as much as like Odell is on one extreme of not really caring and pushing Wendy past what her body could take her. I feel like Lynn is on the complete other side of not even letting Wendy explore. Like, Wendy's not really driving Wendy's progress. Lynn is smothering her. Odell wants to push her like past her breaking point. And I feel like just Lynn as a character, it also in her relationships with Jennifer and Anissa, it's the same thing, because she's like, the whole reason why Jennifer ran away in the first place is because she felt like she was being smothered. Like last week with the scare with Markovia that is also as a plot point that's been dropped completely. But, you know, Anissa gets shot and she's telling her mom that, you know, I'm okay. And, like, Lynn just doesn't believe it. And I just, like, this whole just, like, super focus on Lynn as a motherhood, this, like, the overwhelming characteristic trait. And there's no kind of balance or depth. It's just become, like, very, like, one note to me. And that one note of her wanting to be the mother is, I don't even know how to explain it. It's just not like, I don't know. She's just putting people in like protective blankets. And I feel like it doesn't really add much to her character. It doesn't really give her a lot of places to go with that one personality trait. I feel like with Lynn's situation, it's not like Lynn doesn't know how she got into the situation. She practically badgered her way onto the position to work for the ASA to protect these kids. But it doesn't really seem like she has much of a plan. I feel like her decisions are more heavily weigh in the fact that she's a mother than they do really any kind of scientific or strategic sense. And I just like that whole generalization thing of Lynn equals mother and nothing else, I think hurts her character a little bit. And then I'm also a little bit, I'm getting tired of Jennifer shading Anissa's relationship with Grace and comparing it to hers with Khalil, as if Jennifer was like some gold standard. Like she even when like the whole family got together and they're, you know, at some point, Jennifer's like, at least, you know, it's not like me and Khalil. It's like, why are you comparing like your parent relationship to you and Khalil? Like you are not, I know like, you know, first love is big. Or whatever, but it's, you know, I feel like the show even is trying to hold all the other relationships to the standard of Jennifer and Khalil, and that's not really, like, a high standard for, you know, relationship excellence, so, yeah.
That's fair. And while I did like that Jennifer wasn't that terrible with regards to Anissa's problems as she had been before, I also don't like that she keeps comparing it to her relationship with Khalil. Like, she's 16 or 17 years old, and the fact that she thinks all her hope died with Khalil is a disservice because, one, they were barely even in a relationship, and two, she's still too young and believes that Khalil's death is the end of the world for her love life when that was never going to be the case. So, of course, I get that she's grieving, but it does continue coming off as this mopey, woe-me type of grief that leads her to undermining Anissa's feelings and relationship and being really rude about it. And I also dislike that we only got to see Grace for 2 seconds. Like, I appreciate that it's giving us more Thunder Grace, even though it's one-sided right now. But I believe the search for Grace is being dragged out. And I wish Anissa would finally find her, or Grace would let herself be found. Especially now that it should be obvious to her that Anissa and Thunder are the same person. And then finally, while I did like that Lynn stood up to Odell, she knows what kind of man he can be. And since she cares a lot about Wendy, I feel like she could have faked being into his plan so that she could continue working and being there.
That would have been cool. Yeah. That would have been something, but that's not what they did.
Yeah. And also, I was displeased that Jefferson at the end like didn't tell his family what happened with Lala, because that's going to come back and bite him in the ass. Do we have any predictions?
I just think that Lala is going to be the one that actually kills Tobias. And maybe Tobias actually dies this season. Like, he may come back later in some other season, but since I've been saying all season long that they've been building for Markovia as being, like, the thing in season 3, then Tobias is going to have to be out of the way.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good prediction. That would bring us back full circle.
Agreed. And they could resurrect him now that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have the technology.
With big-ass tattoos of Todd and Khalil.
Yeah, and Jefferson's dad. Oh, that would be interesting. Tati, do you have any predictions?
No.
Okay. Moving on to Doom Patrol. As the team recovers from the fight at Fooktopia, Willoughby Kipling, a magician and an old friend of Niles Calder's, unexpectedly conscripts the Doom Patrol into helping him avert the end of the world by stopping a nihilistic cult. Unfortunately, the Doom Patrol fails and the apocalypse begins. What did we like about this episode?
I like how quickly they got to the point with the apocalypse. It didn't take them all season. They were just like, hey, there's an apocalypse. It's happening now. Just kidding.
There's an apocalypse this season.
Yeah. I liked the start of the episode. That was super eerie. Established the cult in a really creepy way. I definitely was like, how are people going to stop this? Oh, my God. So, yeah, good job with that. I also... You know, once again, Larry and Cliff being confronted by their pasts and their fears was really well done. And I continue to think it's funny watching Victor try to lead a team that doesn't even know that it wants to be a team. I like the introduction to Kip. I like Mark Trevor's performance. The singing horse, the unicorn, the singing horse with the nail on his head was like my favorite thing. I love that song. It was super creepy, but I was like, yes, you go. You sing that story, singing horse. Also poor Elliot. I thought that they did a really good job with Elliot. Like, I felt super bad for him. All these people standing around discussing his fate while he's just literally right there. He's right there. But yeah, I definitely felt the stakes with like wanting to save him, you know? And obviously, of course, preventing the apocalypse, but mostly please don't kill this child who has not done anything but have a really ugly tattoo all over his body. I love the Janis Joplin dental floss. I don't know. Just like random detail that's like the most powerful force or whatever. I was like, all right. And I liked Rita standing up to Victor. Because we'll talk about, you know, that being a dislike. But I liked that she did stand up to him and that she also got to prove to herself that she really does have what it takes to be a hero. Even if she's reluctant most of the time. When push comes to shove, she is going to do the right thing and she will do it, you know, for the right reasons even. She doesn't like seeing people in pain. She doesn't like seeing people that she cares about going through a tough time. So she will put aside her own fears to help them out in the end. I loved, like, actually getting to see her use her elasticity, like, for a purpose and, like, with a shape when she stopped Kip. Like, I was like, whoa, she is an elastic woman, you know? So that was good. Because normally we've just seen her be a blob. So this is great. I liked the trip to, I can't remember what it's called now.
Nurnheim.
Yeah. Jane's Oliver Twist personality. I don't know why. I found that one really humorous. Probably because it's just so different from normal. I guess there's also Baby Doll. But, like, most of her personalities are, like, super aggressive and angry and, like, you know, full of powers that are going to kill you. And then there's just Oliver Twist.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
So, yes. I again liked that Kip brought up Vix's reliance on technology, just because I think that we'll get back to the root of that, you know, that being like what is real about him and what has been programmed. So I hope that we're going to get to see that develop more as it goes on. I liked the negative energy sort of like popping up to reveal whatever it wanted to reveal about Niles Calder and the, you know, like with the tape. I was like, you don't have a voice. One way to show that you would like to have one is to play a tape of someone trying to give you a voice. Good job. So yes, he is quite clever. But yeah, mostly, I already said I love Rita. Rita's the thing I love the most about the episode. And also King and Queen of Vernheim. They were super creepy. They were very like, I don't know, like Queen of Hearts, like Alice in Wonderland vibe. But, like, the, like, super goth version. And so I enjoyed them for their, like, 2 seconds. Especially just, like, you know, poor slit throat dad, the king, was just, like, there with a slit throat, but in full makeup. Because why not? Yep. So there you go.
Yeah, I actually, after a kind of long and trying introspective look into the selfish background of Larry and the annoying pal that is Cliff, set to the backdrop of Nazis and Fruitopia last week. I really enjoyed this random detour into an apocalyptic plot based totally off of a kid who is also a book and heroes and villains and other whole dimensions that are also based entirely off of like literary concepts. I just thought that was like a nice like breath of fresh air, a nice break. It's like a fucked up Reading Rainbow. Like that's kind of cool. Like who would think to do that? The Knights of Templar dude named Kipling, he recites nursery lines from a children's book to ward off ladies of the razor, which are basically nuns with razor blades that cut through walls. They're assassins that are made out of letters that were never sent. Like, this is awesome. The end of the world is hidden in a fairy tale from hell, and the portals to the world are stigmata of a Catholic priest. Like, this is all, like, weird and dark. And there's also, it's kind of, like, interesting because there's these dark connections of, like, the Catholic Church, and then you've got children's stories and, you know, like, how children's stories are, they have, like, two different meanings, right? So a lot of fairy tales seem like innocent, you know, fun, fantastical stories, but they have, like, actually really dark meanings behind a lot of, you know, like the Grimm's tales and things like that. And the same thing that you could say with like the Catholic Church and like the what the one love on what the Catholic Church means. And then there's also like that the darkness and perversion, and both of those things are kind of coming into play in like this episode. And it's like being like perverted into this horoscope of Nurnheim. And the fact that the end of the world requires the sacrifice of a child, aka the book. All this stuff is like going on. It's really kind of interesting when you kind of like break it all down. And then especially following after last week, the characters, I like that there was actual progress between Larry and the negative spirit, the negative energy. And that the spirit may finally be close to finding his voice. And it's really weird because like last week, I could have said it when we recorded, but I didn't really think about it until later. But this whole time, when we met Larry, had the idea that the negative spirit or the negative energy is the one that took over Larry. And Larry is the victim. And then you see in the last week's episode that Larry's not actually as much of a victim as maybe we thought he was. And that maybe the spirit is the victim. And so the little energy spirit, maybe... he didn't even, like, the energy spirit didn't even want to be with, like, he's, if he could have any other host body, like, he definitely would. I say he, but, like, it. So the fact that we don't even know now that if it was its choice to bond with Larry is something, but now, obviously, it can't leave Larry. So getting more glimpses of the negative energy and maybe being close to figuring out its voice. I thought it was a really cool development from last week. With Rita, very proud of Rita. I thought, we'll talk about this later, but the forced conflict with Vic was just stupid. But the scene where she talks to Elliot off the ledge, because he's ready to just end it all, and she like talks him off the ledge, very like, not even like, you have so much to live for kind of thing, but she was very like, the way that she did it was very true to her, but also showed how much she cared, and how she subsequently protects Elliot from Kipling. That was a really huge moment for her. Jane and Cliff, I did actually like, this is one show where I did like where they were isolated, because Cliff is getting on my nerves, and so I liked having less of him in a little isolated plot. But I did like, in regards to Cliff, in this episode, that he repeatedly calls Hammerhead's name, so we in the audience know which personality we're dealing with, because they haven't been doing that with Jane before. So I like that he kept mentioning that we are dealing with Hammerhead, so I keep that straight in my mind. And I do like that Hammerhead called Cliff out on his toxic masculinity, even if her reasoning wasn't all that solid. I just like that somebody on the show called Cliff toxic, because I feel like he is, and I feel like it needs to be brought up. But, I mean, it's not like Jane's, like, the reasoning was a little weak, because Jane's personalities are not, you know, fluffy bunnies either. But, anyway. And then, like, Nurnheim, just, like, the actual dimension of Nurnheim, and, like, the mother's, Elliot's mother also being, like, the queen here, and how she stripped down both Cliff and Jane so that they see how they see each other, and you really do see how the connections that we thought were making, which I don't know which connections Matt Bomer was making, the connections that we thought were making and the show was making, was that Cliff sees Jane as his daughter, and how Jane, like, maybe like the little girl might be actually like the real Jane, like who that actually is, or whatever her name. I think the queen said Kay. Someone said Kay, so maybe that is the core personality. I don't know. But all of that I thought was really interesting.
Core personality is Kay.
Yes. So that was cool.
Now that you have talked about all the things that you liked, I feel like I appreciate this episode more because that's not how I felt about it.
Yes.
So all of those, like, you know, parallels that you drew and all that stuff, that was really good. So appreciate that. I really did enjoy Rita's subplot this episode, though. Like, so far, she's been very removed from wanting to be a hero or even considering herself someone who can offer help. So I like the fact that she was the one to help Elliot realize that his life was worth it and that he shouldn't give up. So she was really gentle and kind with him in a way that no one else was. And I think it went a long way for him truly feeling like he deserved to fight for a chance to live despite all that's happened to him. And I also like the fact that we got another persona from Crazy Jane and that this time she didn't show up and just disappear in the blink of an eye. We got to spend a little bit more time with her and realize that she was running scared from Cliff because she viewed him as a monster, which is understandable to a certain degree because she had thought that he was someone she could feel safe around. And I also liked the opening scene and thought it was especially creepy with, like, the birthdays and the overly happy parents before it kind of turned into, like, a horror movie. and then finally, like, that we got some development of the negative energy inside Larry. We've had a lot of time to spend with Larry so far and not enough time with the voiceless companion inside of him. And I thought that the episode did a good job in showcasing that there's more to Chief than meets the eye, and also showing that the negative energy has something to say and seems like it has a mission of its own, which is why it's always against what Larry wants to do. And like Jess said, you know, that Larry is actually not as much of a victim as we and he has shown us to be. But what do we not like about the episode?
I just felt like it was very similar, like, plot-wise to Titans, in, like, we must save this child from becoming a vehicle for the apocalypse. But it also felt like a Legends episode. I just am, like in terms of just, like, the dynamic, especially with, like, Pseudo-Constantine coming in and being like, okay, you misfits, let's try and figure this out. So it just seemed strange to me that it just, like, started happening after three episodes that were not like that at all. So, I guess it would have been one thing if it was, like, the second episode was like that, to establish, like, and now we're going to have cases of the week. But it seemed, like, almost, like, too late in the game for it. I don't know, I guess. But, you know, it's not like it wasn't a bad episode. I still enjoy lots of things about it, as I said. Also, the parallels between between Cliff, Cliff's daughter, and Jane are so strong. And I just want to ask Matt Bomer if he's okay. Because he definitely said that it was romantic between Jane and Cliff. And I'm like, he literally imagined his daughter laying on him. And then it was Jane. Well, it was baby doll, but still. So I'm like, why? One of your personalities is literally like the age that his daughter should be or was when he last saw her. All right. So, yeah. Really awkward. I don't like it. Okay. I feel like we already know Cliff and Larry, like, the back of our hands. So I want to branch out to everyone else's past. And they did do a little bit of that. We got, like, little hints for Rita, especially, and Victor and Jane, especially now we know the name Kay. But it still feels like they're, like it's, like, an IV drip of those three, as opposed to, like, full-on backstory episodes for the other two. So I'm ready to even that out. Also, I got that they were hammering home the point of Rita's cowardice, but people were being way harsh to die. I feel like Victor is the only one who really wants to be a hero. Everyone else is varying degrees of reluctant, so we didn't need to, like, all shit on Rita, especially Victor. But, like, everyone was, like, shitting on Rita for, like, being the like, odd man out or whatever. And I was like, let everyone work at their own pace, okay? Please. And then she did, you know, step up. So, whatever. Jane and Hammerhead, Hammerhead through, or Jane via Hammerhead, whatever. Thinking that Cliff was a monster was, like, super weird to me. Like, I like that she called out him for his toxic masculinity, because he is that, generally speaking. But in the context of the argument, I was like, what is happening? Weren't you also killing Nazis? Like, I don't understand. And it's like, I don't know, I guess it's like she saw him one way, and then she's forced, like, I have to imagine that it's, like, obviously something very bad happened with, like, a male figure, right? Authority figure of some kind. And that's why she also freaked out with the priest. And so seeing Robot Man, seeing Cliff in this different light, seeing him have done, when he seemed like a toy to her at first, right? Like just a super innocuous male, but only in like the strictest sense of the word, I guess, you know, that she could interact with safely. And now she sees that it's not true. So like, but I didn't like see that in the episode, you know, that's me being like, why did this happen? That's what happened, I assume. So I didn't like the argument was happening, but if they delve into Jane's story and give us that, then I will like it retroactively. I also, yeah, same, I mean, same thing with, like, when she freaked out on the priest. I was like, oh, okay, this is, like, some kind of glimpse into her trauma, but it does not make sense right now. I'm like, why is this poor priest suffering? So, yeah. Anyway, the fight in, it's not even really a fight, but, like, the little, like, banter that Vic and Kip had going on with, like, science and magic, I was like, okay. Like, it was, like, super basic. Like, I was just like, I guess it's kind of like the Kallax and Brady.
A little bit rock and roll.
Yeah, right, yeah. I was just like, all right, I guess, like, I don't know if this is supposed to be just, like, cute humor, but I was like, you guys can move on from this. This is dumb. And at the end, it was like, oh, my God, your science was so magical. Oh, wow, your magic is so scientific. Like, yeah, okay, thank you. Sesame Street episode. So, yeah. Anyway. I also don't think that this is the plot I would have chosen to stretch out into two episodes. I am invested in Elliot, but as much as I was like, oh, Kip is cool, he did feel a kind of Constantine knockoff. So, like, I'm not really, like, I don't know that he earned his little, like, heel face turn at the end there. You know, like, do I care if, like, Kip doesn't agree that they should keep this child alive and wants to kill him? I don't really care, as long as they succeed in saving him. So, yes, there you go.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Like, I felt it too, that this episode did feel very legendy to me. The whole, we have to save the world and the team that doesn't want to be a team. And especially I think the point where Hip sends Jane or Hammerhead and Cliff to Spain to sew up the priest's hands. And he's like, you have this one job. Do not hesitate doing this one job and fuck it up. And that's exactly what happens. Like, this feels like a legends moment about to happen. And that's exactly what happened. So, yeah, I felt strong Legends vibes there. I definitely agree with Matt Bomer being weird. But that's, it really doesn't have anything to do with the episode. But just the fact that he somehow, this is supposed to turn into, like, a romantic thing between Cliff and Jane. Like, I just don't, I don't know. It makes me feel uncomfortable watching their scenes together, especially like in the beginning scene where, you know, she wakes up laying with him and it's like, oh, this is really uncomfortable knowing what Matt said about what this is supposed to be.
He,
like,
tainted it.
It's tainted for me. Yeah. And then you go like the Nernheim when they're actually like stripping away layers of Cliff and Jane, and you see like the little girl, and that's how, you know, is that how Cliff sees Jane, or is that how, or is that just like her, like Kay's true form, and that, you know, and it's not related to Cliff and Jane, but it is related, and it's just like weird. Yeah. I did not like the fight either between, the fight between Hammerhead and Cliff. But that was like okay on terms of whether it worked for the plot. More so than the fight between, or the tension or whatever between Victor and Rita. Like, I felt like that one was more forced, especially seeing the conversation that they had the week before about both feeling afraid. I think that Victor is way too serious. He needs to unclench a little bit. Like, I don't see why he needed to be so harsh on Rita, as, and like, Rita had a point that Larry is just as negative as she is about the whole being a hero thing. And yet Rita's the only one that doesn't get invited to like the group meeting that none of them wanted to be at. It's kind of like, you know, when you feel like, I really don't want to go to whatever this event my friends are having, but I would also be offended if I was not invited to go. Like, at least invite me so I can politely decline or something. Like, I feel like I just, Victor just feels very, like, tight to me. And I'm wondering if some of that, and I guess this could flow into predictions, but is some of that because of Silas and the whole programming versus who Victor is? I just feel like he needs to, like, get, like, I would love for him to accidentally get high, you know, or something to, like, mess with the circuitry and make it feel like he's high. Like, I remember Deadly Class, like, recently did an episode where Marcus, like, accidentally takes 7 hits of acid, and, like, the whole episode is an acid trip. And I would love that for Victor and probably Larry. Like, Larry needs to get high as well. And it's an acid trip episode is something that Doom Control, as a show, could definitely do. And I just feel like they just need to do that so, like, Victor learns to, like, be a little bit looser in, you know, his personality. I thought, like, the whole thing, and it wasn't just, like, Victor versus Rita, but it was also, like, all the other Doom Patrol members versus Rita, which is also kind of, like, a little bit hypocritical because none of them wanted to be heroes or be a team. So how are they any... How are they like, looking at Rita, like, well, you know, at least we're not Rita kind of thing. It just felt very unnecessary and borderline sexist that Rita got so much crap for not wanting to be a part of the team, but Larry doesn't. So, yeah, I didn't like that.
I actually found myself not liking this episode of Doom Patrol, though. I feel like now I just have to go back and rewatch it. But as much... like, I didn't like it as much as I liked the previous 3 episodes. I think that there was a lot of exposition, and that exposition weighed the episode down because there was a lot going on, and I thought that it could have been told better because it really felt like there was a whole new storyline being introduced, and it didn't really factor in with the Doom Patrol, that it kind of felt like they were riding on the coattails of what was happening rather than being, like, active members of what was going on. So we got some nice development for Rita, but there was something that just felt off about the whole thing for me. And there wasn't enough time to really flesh out much. I know that this was, like, a 2-part episode, but within this episode, it just felt like a lot of things were rushed between getting to know that there's a guy who has a book written all over him, to stopping people from attacking the guy who had the book written all over him, to being kidnapped. Anyway... So, and when there's usually, like, a lot of new characters being introduced, it's better if the plot slows down a little bit so that we can catch up as viewers. Otherwise, it just seems like a lot of mishmash of chaos happening on screen, and that's what it felt like for me. And I think the episode tried really hard to progress the character development from the last couple of episodes, and it worked in some instances. And I think it would have been nicer had they accidentally happened upon this man who is essentially a book, and then they felt the need to protect him, even though they probably wouldn't, because knowing who they are. But if it would have just felt like they were doing less reacting to what was going on. And then a little bit hypocritical for Jane to be scared of Cliff, considering that Hammerhead and some of her other personalities can be violent and have been violent before. But I am sure that it has to do with her own trust issues, and maybe she's just, like, seeing Cliff in a light that she didn't want to see him in, because she had considered him, like I said before, like a safe space. But in that moment, or at least until we figure out what's going on with her, that part of the plot felt like she could have been expanded upon. And then considering that Cyborg and Rita seemed to come to a realization, like, was it last episode or the episode before, and a moment in their relationship, it felt like that Cyborg was blatantly so mean to her, being so mean to her about her lack of involvement, like you guys already said. And I know that he wants her to step up and that he thinks that she can, but he should have realized that the more he pestered her about it or made comments, the more she was going, like, to go back into her shell and just be pissed off. And then finally, it's apparently being implied that Cliff and Crazy Jane are going to be having a romance, which makes this episode even stranger for me, because they really went all in with the constant comparisons to his daughter and Jane being like a daughter to him. So it obviously explains why he has been so protective of her. So given that the show has shown these parallels between Jane and his daughter consistently since, like, the first episode, it makes no sense that they're trying to develop a romance between them, especially after Jane realizes the quote-unquote monster that Cliff is and shies away from him throughout this episode. So it just makes the whole thing come off as really creepy. So I hope that Matt is just, like, misinterpreting what he's reading. because he thinks it should be versus like what actually is. But anyway, moving into predictions. Do we have any?
No.
The world will not end.
Yeah, the world will not end.
Okay, great. And then we have our Lady with Gumption Side B nominations. Who do we pick
for this? Rita! Rita for sure.
Yeah. Tanya from The Flash?
Yes.
Yeah.
She went out of her way to save that shark man. And now she's brave enough in the face of the ridicule that Shape of Water she is brave enough to pursue and follow her heart.
And I think you could put, like, well, no, because then y'all get on me. But I was going to say, like, well, I guess, no, I'm going to fight for this. Iris for working through her PTSD on, like, I felt like that was a good
would we fight character you on
moment
that,
for her.
No, I wasn't going to, I was going to say Iris, and then I was like, they're going to fight me on that. So let me skip over to Tanya.
Okay. So, okay, so she's Iris and Tanya and Rita, and then I guess for Black Lightning and Nyssa for continuing to search for Grace. Mm-hmm. But as far as like a final from side A and side B,
yeah. So for side A, we had Felicity,
Alex, and Melissa. Felicity. Mm-hmm. I would say Alex.
Yeah, I would agree. Kinda. With that.
So I think I would. I would say Alex, I guess.
I think it's like a close race on side A, but probably yeah. I would say Alex. Well,
right, but I don't know. Like the whole like Felicity leaving clues. The future Felicity is like canceling out present Felicity.
That's true. That's true. Future Felicity is canceling out present Felicity. But present Felicity did a good job.
And she did. Future Felicity can defend herself in an episode.
Yeah,
but I think like with Alex and you know going against the DEO and choosing to work with choosing to work with Supergirl and Super Friends. Getting back to like the core Alex, so even if she doesn't have her memory, she still is the same Alex.
Agreed.
I thought that was good for her, and the fact that she is going to actively subvert the government by doing the whole side project with Lena.
Oh yeah,
agreed
for sure. So Alex for side A, and who do we have Alex for side A. B?
Finally,
Rita. Rita's the strongest one for me.
Rita's probably the strongest one. Yeah.
All right, so Alex and Rita's showdown. Drum roll.
Rita had it most recently.
Yes. So I would probably give it to Alex. Yeah. I'd give it to Alex.
Even though overall I think it's Rita. But
but for the sake of diversity of awards.
Yes. We're doing Alex, like Oscars. We're giving awards like after you've done a lot of great work and then suddenly like we find that you need this now.
Yeah, exactly. Or actually, we're doing what the Oscars aren't brave enough to do, which is say Meryl Streep won enough times. We are giving it to the other person.
Exactly. All right. So Alex Danvers, I was going to say side A. Alex Danvers is the winner for episode 60. No, 74. Close. I was 10 episodes off. Join us next week for covering all these DC TV shows again in another 2.5+ hour podcast.
We're back. Long-ass podcast.
Yes, where we hope next week we will have more positive feelings about some of the shows.
Yay!
Until next time, bye.
Bye.
Bye.